us today. And now, if everyone will please remain standing, we'll flip around to the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you again to Aidan and Riley for joining us this morning. Moving on to planning staff updates. We'll just skip public comment this morning. No. All right, backwards. Public comment before planning staff updates. I have one speaker slip in from Mr. Greening. Surprise, surprise. Good morning.
Good morning, and I am Eric Greening, and I am still not feeling completely at rest about a particular issue, but I'll start with the Sufi story about the guy. I don't know that it was originally contact lenses, but I guess in the modern version it's contact lenses. It's gotten dark. He's on a deserted street, and he's on the ground under the streetlight looking for his contact lens, and this person comes along and says, what are you looking for? My contact lenses. And, well, did you lose them here? No, I lost them down the street there. Well, why are you looking here? Because here's where the light is. And, of course, that is analogous to what we're doing with the land use and circulation element rural plan update relative to identifying appropriate areas for communities to grow. We are looking outside the urban and village reserve lines as part of this process. The community plans inside the lines are for later, with the exception of Shandon, which is already in the pipeline. We're not going to be looking in the places that our strategic growth plans tell us are the first places to look. We're first going to be looking where they tell us not to look unless we have no other alternatives. And so I know I raised this issue during the scoping, but I'm going to raise it again because the process is going to be unfolding. And even if you're not part of it collectively, you're probably going to be part of it individually in your districts, in community meetings. And I'm just hoping that all of us are aware, the planning staff and all of us are aware, that we need to tell the people in the communities that we're not biased in favor of their growing outside the lines, that we're not insisting that they grow outside the lines, that we're not pushing them to grow outside the lines, that essentially all this process is to do is to be sort of a placeholder for if they can't find something appropriate inside the lines when they actually have the designated process for doing so. Because I'm very, very concerned that we're only going to look under the streetlight when the actual thing we're looking for is someplace else. Thank you.
Mr. Greening, moving to analogy this week, I note. Anyone else here? I have no more speaker slips for public comment. Anybody else have any comments on anything not on the agenda? Okay, seeing no one, we'll close public comment and move on to staff updates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Warren Hope from the Department of Planning and Building, and what I wanted to talk about, doing it on the regular meeting date of Thursday, April 8th. So far, there's only one other item on that agenda, and it's a short one. So we're looking at least a half day and possibly more to do this. What we did last year was we started the regular meeting in this room. We took care of the regular business, finished it, then we adjourned to the conference room. We have a conference room 271 on the second floor of this building reserved for April 8th. We would go up there. We brown bagged it last year. We all brought our brown bag lunches, and we just kind of worked through lunch. We can do that again if that's your commission's desire. What I wanted, the chair and I wanted to ask the rest of the commission today is what kind of items, start thinking about what kind of items you'd like to have on the agenda, not expecting answers right now, but possibly at a subsequent meeting, we can then discuss possible topics for the Planning Commission retreat. Some of the perennial topics that we've had at the last three retreats that might be worth looking at for carrying over include the commission discussion of how they see their roles as commissioners, a Planning Commission roundtable discussion of their vision and desires for the county next year and 5 years and beyond. We usually have an update on the study sessions list that your commission has formulated in the past, and I usually update that for your commission. It's letting you know what we've done, what's still to be done, and what new ones you'd like to have. And then there's an opportunity for other topics. We had some specific topics last year that were relevant at the time that they've been dealt with, so now there's an opportunity for new ones. So please be thinking about that, and since we're doing it on a regular meeting date, there's no need for you to look at your schedule and squeeze another meeting in, but hopefully that will work on April 8th. So that concludes my contributions to staff updates. In terms of public comment, Mr. Greening has made these comments before in other forums like the EIR scoping session, and they've been responded to by long-range planning staff. I think the short answer is that the intent of the land use and circulation element is not to divert additional development into the rural areas, but to instead try to implement the provisions of the Clean Climate Action Plan, the Clean Air Plan, and other requirements of recent state legislation focusing on those issues. And it will be, I'm sure, a constant topic of conversation as the project proceeds through the process, which will be a couple-year process. And I suggest that a more detailed discussion of Mr. Greening's comments be deferred until those other discussion points in the process, and with the staff participants in the actual update itself. So that's my response to public comments. Is there any questions from the commissioners?
Any questions for Mr. Hogue?
Yes, I did, Mr. Hogue. I understand that the Templeton Properties application at the Stockyard in Templeton was approved by the board to go forward through the environmental review process and will be coming back to us.
That is correct.
And I was wondering if you can give us any detail on that.
Well, you pretty much just covered it. But,
okay.
But I can talk longer.
Well, one of the things, I watched that hearing, and one of the things that I picked up in my mind anyway, it was a monumental decision by the board that the strategic growth policies, as far as trying to implement metropolitan-type policies in rural areas, was not going to be accepted by the communities. And specifically, I was pleased to hear Supervisor Hill's comments that strategic growth has been around long enough throughout the country and has been, his words were, he's a student of smart growth or strategic growth, and that historically across the country that any time extreme metropolitan-type strategic growth policies are tried to be implemented in the rural communities, they're rejected across the board. And I've spoke to that here quite a bit, that was my concern. And I'm not a student of strategic growth, so it was interesting to see that is the case, because that's been a concern of mine all along.
Well, I think I can just expand on that a little bit. You're absolutely right. That is what Mr. Hill said. But first of all, I want to go back to something else you said. This site was not in a rural area. It's within an urban reserve line. It's within a developed community with community services.
I stand corrected. Rural community. I should have said rural community, but I think you understand.
One was, you know, the handling of the creek and where the appropriate setback should be. The other was where the location of on-site public outdoor recreation area should be and whether it was in the best location or not. And they were pretty clear to the applicant they were expecting to see some form of redesign to address those two issues.
Yes, absolutely.
And it was because of that I asked the board to clarify their motion as to what can happen is when a project has been acted on by the commission and then appealed to the board, but the board wants to have it keep going, that it comes back directly to the board. But I clarified with the board that after we prepare the initial study and an environmental determination, it will come back to your planning commission first, because you didn't really get an opportunity to have the information we will develop on those design issues. But I think your input will be invaluable on those issues alone. The issue of whether it should be built to a minimum density is really off the table now. The board has decided it doesn't have to be built to a minimum density in the residential multifamily category, which was the key issue that your commission really looked at. So you will have an opportunity to have all that information in front of you and give the board advice on the design issues. Then it will come back to the board for final action because they still retain jurisdiction because of the appeal. So really, there's been no final decisions other than the board is interested in seeing the project move forward, have some redesign to address some specific design issues, and come through you and then come back to the board.
That was exactly my understanding.
Okay.
Thank you.
And that's why I also heard some of that hearing, and I remember Supervisor Gibson saying, and this by no means ensures an approval of the project. It's just the okay, as Mr. Hope said, to proceed.
Yes, and we actually haven't seen a project, so that's the instruction that was given, and that's what we'll be coming
back again. Any other questions for Mr. Hope? I had a few. Mr. Hogue, regarding the staff retreat, if you would please send out the draft agenda items to all of us. Everybody could maybe look through those then and think about what's already on that tentative agenda and what you may want to add to that.
Well, I guess we have a cart and horse issue here because we haven't developed any.
Well, you have a list you just showed
me. Yeah,
yeah. And it may be helpful.
What I can do is send you an email of, this is what we've done in the past, you might want to consider doing
right.
again.
Right, and what we've talked about then for online training.
I can do that to prompt your thinking about what other specific topics you might like to see addressed.
Right, and then within those general topics, I think that would help everyone maybe hone in on more specific topics within those sort of that general list of what they're interested in, so we could target that time and be most effective there. The other question I have then is the Wilson appeal. On Tuesday, went to the soups. Tell us what happened there.
Well, I wasn't a direct participant in that, but as I understand it, they denied, or the Planning Commission denied the Wilson vacation rental request when it came to you. The applicant appealed that to the board, and the board denied the appeal on a unanimous vote.
So they went
I'm looking
that.
In the audience to see if there's anyone else that participated in that. Carrie, she didn't participate in it. I believe that is what occurred.
Okay, and I did hear some of that, and so I think that was certainly refreshing to see the decision, our unanimous decision, upheld there at that level. And can you talk a little bit about then, it kind of raises the issue of minor use permit requests for vacation rentals. And procedurally, that's changed within the department a bit and the procedure level here. And maybe a next step there or what might happen. Is there some talk of a nuisance ordinance or some kind of remedy for the ongoing issues with vacation rentals?
The board has asked the department to come up with a proposal to develop more performance standards for vacation rentals, particularly in the noise area, noise impact area, and staff is working on some ideas at this point. I'm, again, not a direct participant in that process, so I can't give you more specific information, but if you'd like more, I can ask the staff that's working on that to report back to your commission at a subsequent meetings update session.
Yes, please, if you would. I think that's interesting because we have an ongoing problem, and the Wilson project was just one of many. So I think that would be helpful to know what staff is working on that, so we have some sense of trying to get ahead of that problem, how we're going about it. Thank you for that. And with that, we'll move on to our consent agenda. We have minutes from December 17. Any questions or changes to those minutes anyone would like to make?
Look into other agencies that are using our Granicus live streaming system and see if they do it differently than the board and better, so that, because we don't want to, we want transparency in government and we want the public's voices heard. So it might just be the way the board is doing it that we're following them. And so Mr. Greening's idea to bring it up to the board at their public comment is taken well. That would be appreciated.
Okay. So if we could continue to look into that, then I think we all understood his point that having thoughts not sort of included, well, at least brief ideas into those minutes could be.
And more importantly than that, I think what we all agreed with, I remember my comment when Mr. Greening made his, was absolutely. And it was that the public, it is in fact a public hearing, and that the public should be given equal level of detail in the minutes as any other speaker. And in the past and currently in these minutes before us, that's not the case. And so I agree wholeheartedly with Mr. Greening, and hopefully the board will see it the same way.
Okay. And Mr. Greening, is that so?
I just wanted to interject that I am glad that Commissioner White brought this up, because I concur wholeheartedly that we need to do this.
And so maybe we could open then public comment on the consent agenda. Mr. Greening's card is in and he's up. If there are others who would like to comment on the consent agenda or this topic, now's the time. Get your slips in. Mr. Greening?
Thank you. And I appreciate the commission's support and the commission's recognition that the public are equal partners in the process. That's why it's called a public hearing. Just one additional point that could be made, each of you individually with your appointing supervisor and we in the public collectively with the supervisors, and that is, if they're concerned with conciseness and saving time, it does not save them time if the public does not see its issues reflected in the minutes. I know if I don't see that the supervisors are hearing the issues we raised here, then we're going to show up there and take another 3 minutes there to be sure they're aware of it. So if the minutes only give our names and not the issues, then it's going to take their hearings longer. We're going to make sure they know what was said, whether they read it or whether they hear it. Thank you.
They're either promised, yeah. Okay, anyone else wanting to weigh in on this item or the minutes on the consent agenda? Bring it back to the commissioners. Any more comment or discussion on this? Do I hear a motion to approve?
I'll make a motion. We approve.
Second.
Okay. And all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
I have to abstain since I think it's appropriate since I did not. I was not on the commission at the time.
Good. Okay, one abstention. Then we'll move on with that to our first hearing item. If the clerk will please call item number one.
A request by Patea Torrance for a third time extension for minor use permit DRC 2004-00082, Supervisorial District Number 3, Carrie Brown, Project Manager.
Good morning, Carrie Brown, County Planning Staff. The project is a third time extension for minor use permit DRC 2004-00082. To allow a change of use from an antique store to a deli at the old Edna store, and also to allow meetings on the second floor, wine tasting, and events at the site. The site is located on Highway 227. It's also bounded by Max Welton Street and Old Price Canyon. The site has two zoning categories. The old Edna store, which is located right on 227, is zoned commercial retail, and then the back of the lot, the parcel, is zoned residential suburban. This shows the aerial. The old Edna store is up here, and then there's a bunch of another residence, a bed and breakfast, and some other accessory type buildings. This is a site plan of the parcel, or the front half of the parcel, and this shows the old Edna store, the deli, and parking areas, the bed and breakfast, another house, and some other accessory buildings. The old Edna store is designated historic, and the project is to change the use, so there's actually nothing proposed to the building, no structural changes, so the historical nature of the building would not change in any way. This is a photo of the old Edna store. This is kind of a little bit back from 227. And with that, staff recommends approval of the third time extension for minor use permit DRC 2004-0082 based on the findings in Exhibit A and carry over the original findings and conditions. And I'm available for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Question?
I have one question. Doesn't this third time extension start on the day of approval and end 1 year later?
Well, in the coastal portion of the county, that would be the case. Our inland land use ordinance and our coastal land use ordinance are a little bit different when it comes to third time extensions. In the inland portion of the county, the actual date is the original minor use permit approval date. So they're actually lost a month here, but they would be good until January 6th,
okay.
2011.
All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. I have a couple questions. So I know that the Edna Deli has been actually operating as a deli, so they changed the use, because even though they actually haven't met the conditions. But I was wondering if the other uses that were proposed, the events and all that kind of stuff, I don't know anything about whether those uses are also occurring without having met the conditions.
Well, initially the deli was in operation for, I believe, a couple of years. It is no longer in operation since they haven't met their conditions of approval.
It's no longer in. I've been out there. And
it's my understanding it's wine tasting there, which...
Okay. Maybe the applicant can address it.
I can address your other part of the question. The other uses are not occurring.
Okay.
Currently.
Good. And do you know maybe the applicant can again address this? What are the problems with the negotiations in terms of the neighbors and everything that's been? It's been 4 years. Come on.
Right.
I mean, economically, I know that this is not a good time, so I'm not really worried about the extension, but I'm just wondering what's going on with the negotiations.
I'll let the applicant address
okay.
that.
Thanks.
Other questions? Mr. Brady?
Yes, I have a couple. Land Use Ordinance, page 9-232, that's the San Luis Obispo allowable land uses permit requirements. Is that applicable in this case?
This is the Los Ranchos Edna Village area has actually their own table of allowable uses.
Yeah, there's a specific plan
right.
for that. And just to make my point, in the San Luis Obispo allowable land use area, I did not see where restaurants were allowed in the commercial retail land use category. And then when I looked up the specific plan for the Los Osos Edna, there was a statement in there that this particular property was the only area covered by that specific plan that was zoned commercial retail. And there was a paragraph in there that said that needed to be evaluated because perhaps that was not a good use for that area. Are you familiar with that language that's in the plan?
I'm not familiar with that language. The site is owned commercial resale in recognition of the historic structure there and the historical use that it's been occurring on the site since the early 1900s.
Yeah, I was surprised to find that as well, and so that's what prompted my question here this morning.
If I might add to the discussion a moment, Warren Hogue again. My recollection is that what the specific plan was looking at was the possibility that maybe there needed to be another location for commercial retail elsewhere in the village, because that village area goes all the way from Rolling Hills Estates down to the town of Edna, and the only commercial was where the store was, and they didn't. There was the thought that maybe that wasn't central enough to the majority of the population in the village area. And that may have prompted, I don't remember specifically the language you just read, but that may have prompted the idea. And then after the specific plan was adopted, the San Luis Obispo area plan was updated. And there was a discussion about possibly adding some commercial retail at the corner of Los Ranchos Road and Highway 227, which was ultimately not adopted. But I don't recall there was any discussion to eliminate the commercial retail at this project site. That's the most history I can think of to add some insight into this.
Well, I appreciate that, and perhaps that paragraph is amenable to that interpretation. But I would still like to know where in that specific plan it says that eating and drinking establishments and restaurants are an approved use.
Presumably in a commercial retail zone, that's going to be an allowable use.
Well, those are allowable uses normally in the commercial retail land use category, and the staff's recollection is that the Los Ranchos Edna specific plan still allows those too. The specific plan can be more restrictive than the LUE, cannot be less restrictive.
Okay. So you're hunting for that.
Yeah.
Any other questions
as we speak.
For staff then while Mr. Hope hunts for that?
Oh, I see one other one. Temporary events, there's going to be temporary events here at this location. Is that a listed use as well for this?
Let me get back to you on that. I'm actually going to open up the Los Ranchos Edna plan here, too.
We both are. It's a race.
We'll see who finds it the most quickly, whose computer skills are. So with that, let's open this up to the applicant and anyone here from the public who wishes to speak on this item. I don't have any slips yet, but if you will get them in, if anyone else would like to comment on this. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. My name is Carol Florence. I'm a principal planner with Oasis Associates, located in San Luis Obispo, and I'm here this morning representing the applicant, Patia Torrance. This morning, I would just respectfully request that you approve the third time extension based on the six findings that are located in Exhibit A, page 1-3 of your staff report. And I'm more than happy to answer the Commission's questions, and maybe I could start with Commissioner Christensen. My client at this juncture has leased the old Edna building to Stoller Winery, and it is currently a wine tasting facility. Regarding the events, we really haven't pursued those for the distinct reason that we have not been able to comply with the conditions of approval, and those essentially go hand in hand, and that was one of the motivating factors to actually pursue the minor use permit, was to add those events to the current uses. And I'd like to speak to the quote-unquote issues, and hopefully Glenn Marshall can help me with this, because they're really geared toward the improvements. One of those has to do with improvements at Broad Street at, and Max Welton, or 227 and Max Welton. That involves, at this juncture, a portion of that was owned by someone just passed on, and I believe that property now belongs to the state because he had no heirs, so there's some difficulty there. There's a current easement across it for access to the residences to Max Welton. There's also, we are tied at the hip, if you will, with the permit for the McGregor Winery that has the exact same road improvement conditions, and that has to do with abandonment of Old Price Canyon, which is essentially the roadway that runs along the creek. So that needed to be abandoned, and then there was a discussion about, all right, if we abandon that, do we still need a public right-of-way, if you will, if the winery is to be built? And so it is complicated, and I do want to thank the Public Works staff for helping us try to work through all of this, but we're just not at that juncture. And yes, the economy has not been kind to anyone, especially a small establishment and a small business owner in the Edna Valley. So With that said, I would be more than happy to address any of your other questions or comments. I live in the Edna Valley. Actually, I live on the hill above this, so it's my neighborhood as well. And we have a very eclectic neighborhood. On any given day, you can attend a Portuguese Catholic procession, all sorts of events there. So we like the neighborhood the way it is, and we're hoping that Old Edna can thrive as a business establishment there. Even an additional winery, I think it's really an asset to the valley. It's just the times are difficult right now, and I would respectfully request this third time extension.
Did that answer your question?
Yes, it did. That was good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else from the public? Anyone from the public here to speak on this item? That will close public comment and bring it back to the commissioner. From the district?
You know, this is a pretty routine thing. Edna's been there for a long time. I swear I've had a sandwich there recently, but hey, it could just be my imagination. I have a lot of sandwiches in a lot of places. And I certainly know.
So eating and drinking places, personal services, bed and breakfast facilities, food and beverage, retail sales, general merchandise, furniture, home furnishing, and equipment. And temporary events are not listed. We found that they were more of an accessory use to the deli and wine tasting uses at the site.
Okay, I wonder if Mr. Hogue was able to find that paragraph that we both spoke to.
I did find that.
Yes,
oh.
But I'm not on it right at the moment. Well, actually, I'm not sure I found the paragraph that you were discussing. What I did find was a discussion of commercial retail on page 3-5. Was that the one you were talking about?
I'm sorry, I didn't write the page number down.
Okay, give me a second, and I'll get back to it as quickly as
next time I'm going to print and bring it.
Because I was on the same place that Carrie was. Yeah. I'm almost there.
Finding stuff. Yeah. Relocating.
Here we go. The paragraph that I found, oops, it's beeping at me. Okay. The paragraph I found on retail commercial is in the section on land use, and it's number 6, retail commercial. This area, parentheses, subarea 2, constitutes the only commercially designated property within the village and reflects the location of the historic Edna store, parentheses, former Grange Hall. The viability of the old store as a commercial use appears marginal, and the structure is not presently being used for commercial purposes. It was previously used as an antique store. The store is on a portion of a large parcel, most of which is designated suburban residential. The store itself is bounded on 3 sides by Edna Road, Maxwellton Street, and Old Price Canyon Road. The commercial site is nonconforming as to parking, since only a small unpaved area in front of the store is available. The combining designation map shows a flood hazard area along Corral de Piedra Creek, adjacent to the site, which may affect the property. So this was all information that was valid at the time the plan was prepared, which was years before the current applicant has acquired the property and made some improvements.
How old, out of curiosity, when would this plan have been prepared?
Can you scroll quicker to the adoption page? It was in the 80s, I believe.
I'm just curious from the writing of this.
But it was originally adopted before, the area plan update was adopted in 96, and this plan was adopted well before that. Give me a second and I'll scroll some more here.
Well, on the screen, I think is the page that you were referring to, Commissioner O'Grady, on the top.
Yes, thank you. I remember, does not justify commercial use, special standards should be imposed, et cetera. So, yes, that rings a bell.
I think it's outdated.
Well, and we read before parking is
okay.
Gone this morning.
The plan was originally adopted in 1984. And I have here that it was revised March 7th, 2001. That was probably some particular amendment. That had nothing to do with this site.
Well, while we look at this, I would just suggest this is vastly outdated. We've read in here that parking is non-conforming, and working with old structures is difficult, and they don't meet modern codes and standards. But I, for one, am a huge fan of making use of historic structures, and so any question about how this area plan reads and what we want to do, I would disregard any of this outdated language in the area plan. And we don't have any actual conflict. We have some question on interpretation. But I applaud this kind of effort and would hope we could do whatever we need to support these kind of projects and make this kind of small business work.
Yeah, I can accept that what was done here several years ago responds to the special standards developed with all the conditions to improve it. So I just wanted to get this clarified.
My comments, I'd like to make a couple of comments. They just go to the heart of the matter here. This is the last extension until January, and I don't know if the applicant has a want to continue on with this. Obviously, I think they do. They're here. But it goes to Mr. Marshall. Is there any kind of relief that can be given on these improvements, or is there any kind of bonding that could be done so that they can satisfy their conditions?
Sure. Glenn Marshall with County Public Works. In response to your question, as far as bonding, they can bond, but technically if you bond for improvements under a project like this, you have to have those done prior to occupancy, and therefore be prior to occupancy. Originally, the applicant was conditioned to do both an offer and construct the roadway improvements, and through negotiations with the applicant and planning staff, we've all concluded that just an offer for her portion of the project would be sufficient. And no paving. So we've actually come down on the original conditions, kind of toned them down, scaled them down to hopefully make this a viable project.
Sir, will please call item two. Tell us what we're doing.
Is that for item two?
Item two is a request for interpretation of Land Use Ordinance Section 22.06.030 relating to the amount of raw materials required to be extracted on-site for paving material uses in the rural land use category. County file number DTM 2009-00005, all supervisorial districts. Project Manager Jeff Oliveira.
Thank you, Mr. Oliveira. Welcome.
Madam Chair, I'm John Null. I'm with the Department of Planning and Building. This next item is an interpretation of the land use ordinance relating to allowable uses in the rural lands land use category. Mr. Jeff Oliveira is the project manager on this particular item, and at this point, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to Jeff.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Null. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. My name is Jeff Oliveira, Environmental Specialist. And as Mr. Null mentioned, staff is bringing before you this morning a request for land use ordinance interpretation. The interpretation request is focusing on land use ordinance section 22.06.030, and in particular, table 2.2 of this section of the ordinance, which states that paving materials land use is a permitted use in rural lands with site plan review. Before we get into some details, I wanted to actually define that paving materials land use as it's written in our ordinance. And paving materials is defined as manufacturing establishments producing various common paving and roofing materials, including paving blocks made of asphalt, creosoted wood, and various compositions of asphalt. And the land use ordinance states that that the paving materials use in rural lands designated areas is limited specifically to manufacturing operations for which the raw materials are extracted on site. So the conclusion here and the crux of staff's interpretation request is that the land use ordinance is silent on exactly how much or what percentage of these raw materials must be extracted on site. And that's why we're here this morning. If you take a look, this, I don't know if you can read it, but this is the section of the land use that I was referencing, and if you can see my cursor here, paving materials is listed land use, and under rural lands, it is an allowable use with site plan review, and if you continue down that table, that SP6 refers to footnote number 6 in this table, and I had it up on the screen earlier. It says, allowable use is limited to manufacturing operations for which the raw materials are extracted on site. So the summary of staff's request this morning is a recommendation to continue requiring that this land use be limited to the operations that can extract raw materials on site, and that we clarify this by quantifying the amount of imported materials allowed in the finished product of the paving materials use, and to establish that quantity at a maximum 20% allowance for imported materials in the finished product. Before we get into the discussion, we have a few issues to consider, a little bit more information. The raw materials needed for commonly needed for paving materials land use include, but not necessarily limited to, sand, gravel, aggregate, and petroleum products. The paving materials, it's important to note, is an allowable use in rural lands and is limiting this use to operations that extract materials on site can be reasonably interpreted as addressing impacts related to importing, which can be seen as truck trips and traffic issues. Limiting this use to operations where all materials must be extracted on site means any use on rural lands proposing the paving materials use must include an oil well and a development of petroleum refining facility on the site's
presentation, and I'm sorry I didn't bring that up in the first part. Ms. Linda Kinnicky with the Ag Commissioner's Office would like to chime in here at the end, and then we'll be done.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Kinnicky.
Good morning. Linda Kinnicky from the County Ag Department. And so often we have decision makers painted into a corner because a project goes through the process where many years are involved and several hundred thousand dollars are involved, and at the end of the process it's recognized that perhaps this isn't a use that's allowed. So I'd like to start off by really commending the Planning Department for bringing this forward for interpretation, because I think it is important, if there is any shadow of a doubt, that it be clarified before a lot of expense is incurred by the applicant. And I noticed that the staff report states that the ordinance is silent on how much material can be imported. When I read it, I think the ordinance is screaming. It's 100% of the material must be from on-site, with 0% being imported. And the reason that I had asked to speak is because this footnote also applies to agricultural lands. So the interpretation that's made here for rural lands also affects agricultural lands. And just to put in context, the past interpretations, at least as has been presented to the Agricultural Preserve Rules Committee, is that this footnote, intentionally in terms of ag land, was meant to be very limiting. The intention was to allow for the small-scale, perhaps red rock paving material that might be created that could be used. It was intentionally limiting to not allow for vast manufacturing, and it was explained that the industrial uses belonged in the industrial land categories. However, a small-scale on-site extraction only was something that was allowed on the agricultural lands. It's one of the reasons, when the footnotes were explained at how limiting they were, it was one of the reasons that we allowed it to remain on Williamson Act land. Or at least the rules update did. There's review by the APRC, but that's not a restriction to the use. The staff report accurately identifies that this is a highly industrialized use. It wasn't put in context. I really wasn't sure what the paving materials involved, and to be able to understand it, I started to look into it, and it's clear that an asphalt paving use is highly, highly industrialized. And I agree with that statement in the staff report, but a few of the things that I disagree with is that the recommendation to have a sliding scale, or that this footnote allows for, be it 20% or what have you, the small amount, is something that is allowed for in that footnote. I don't see any permissive language to establish a percentage. And what I'd like to remind you is that any amount that's brought in may allow for a land use of high intensity that is not now intended for or allowed for. I do agree with the Planning Department's recommendation to continue the historical application, with my understanding being that application is requiring 100% of the material be from on-site. And if there is a problem, I do appreciate the fact there may be a need for this product, but the problem is not to be addressed opening up rural and agricultural lands for this use, but it could be helping the applicant identify industrial lands that would be appropriate for this. So I hope you realize when your interpretation is being made that it's not only for residential or rural lands, but it would also have vast implications for agricultural lands. Thank you.
Excuse me, Ms. Kennecke, why is that being separated here then? Why are rural lands being called out in ag not?
I'll defer to the planning staff for that.
All right, thank you. Then maybe we'll come back.
I have one question that was for staff, and maybe you can answer it, because I think you referenced that 100% was on site.
That was the explanation that was provided the Agricultural Preserve Rules Committee. That was the interpretation of that footnote. It had been subject to discussion, and it wasn't questioned at that time, nor was there wiggle room or gray area provided for an interpretation of percentage. So I assume that's the historical.
So your understanding is there's no current operations that import the petroleum products?
I'm not aware of, I've got to be honest, I don't follow asphalt plants. I can only go from the information that was provided that helped us make a decision that indicated that this was a very intentionally limiting footnote, and that was during the rules of procedure update.
Okay, thank you.
While commissioners are getting questions ready for staff, I will just say I have only two comments, speaker slips in for this item. I suspect there may be more people here interested in speaking to this. If you will get your speaker slips in now so we get a sense of how many people would like to speak, do that, and we'll go to questions for staff.
Asphalt as a paving material. So when we say final product, we're just saying the final result of the production.
Okay, I hear what you're saying. But I have this similar question, too, about the full range of paving materials, and that they're not only asphalted materials. A full range of paving materials, the asphalted materials would only be a subset of a range of paving materials.
Sure, and we can bring that definition back on the screen. You'll see this definition is taken right out of the land use ordinance, and let's go through it here. It says paving materials, and this is a quote: manufacturing establishments producing various common paving and roofing materials, including paving blocks made of asphalt, creosoted wood, and various compositions of asphalt. So that is the definition we're using for what paving materials is, and we're using asphalt as an example.
But I guess I'll follow along with that. That, to me, it says that, yes, if you could produce asphalt if you, in my mind at this stage, had a petroleum source on your site. But you also could produce compositions of asphalt, in other words, parts of asphalt or gravel for you know. Anyway, I'm just not really sure that. I just was wondering about exactly where you got that, and you explained it, and that's, I understand your explanation.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think there's a differing.
Well, I'm
read of that
right now.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Just a question.
Okay. Just right.
We'll discuss later.
Yes. Other questions that you had?
I've got a few here.
Okay.
I've looked at tried to look at this from every angle possible, and the first question is there any, I asked Mr. Kennecke, is there any existing facilities that produce asphalt on these land use designations?
On rural lands in particular?
Rural lands or ag.
You know, the bulk of the ones that we've investigated are on industrial land, and I believe we have some industry representatives in the audience, and if they have any indication to this use on rural lands, we'd appreciate it. But also keep in mind, in particular, asphalt production is commonly a mobile facility, and it's you'll see it these facilities brought out to job sites to produce asphalt on site. You'll see them in Caltrans right-of-ways producing asphalt to make it right there. You can make it a mobile facility. So it's fair to say that you could bring that that production anywhere that's allowable within the county, or if you're on state right-of-way, you could do that under state authority.
And when I was studying for this, I had the same thoughts as Mr. Kennecke. Maybe the intent here, when this was allowable use on rural lands or agricultural lands, that it just meant, you know, red rock base. But then when you go to the definitions, as you pointed out, it conflicts with that. So I'm struggling between, you know, if we're just being asked here today to make an interpretation, then I'm leaning towards an interpretation that it does not mean the petroleum products, because it would be impractical or impossible to do that. And so why was it designated with those definitions on these lands if the intent was not to bring in some mix for those ingredients that are produced on site?
And that's basically where this question sprung from, is asking that exact same question. Is it feasible for someone in these areas to actually drop an oil well, extract oil, refine it with a refining facility on site, and then mine the rest of it to make asphalt?
So yeah, and I don't believe that was the intent. And if paving
materials... Okay, let's wait for discussion.
Yeah, yeah.
Like questions. Well,
I still want to hear
from the public.
I still got more questions.
Okay.
And so looking at this from every angle, I went to the table that you had up on the screen, and I don't know if you can bring it up again, but it under SP6 designations, there was three others. There were four total that I could find, and one was concrete, gypsum, and plaster products, stone and cut stone products, structural clay and pottery-related products. So I was trying to draw an analogy here to what, you know, if any of these other types of operations would require, you know, a mix to come in to help with the ingredients that are taken on site. And I'm not familiar enough with these types of operations to see if it's possible to pull everything out of the property to manufacture these types of products.
And, you know, staff wasn't prepared today to get into all the other SP6 uses, but the ones that you just mentioned, I think it would be pretty fair to say that they would probably have an easier time getting meeting 100% on-site raw materials requirement versus the that has rural lands that is a blank slate, no existing operations. And if we went forward with this 80-20 split on the finished product, even with that, property owner would have to still be able to extract 80% of their finished product on the site. In this case, we're talking sand, gravel, aggregate, that type of extraction. Yes, it triggers higher land use permit review for the county, and we would be in for a full permit for that.
Would that trigger a review for public input, a full public hearing?
That's correct. I believe it's on rural lands and ag lands, it's a conditional use permit requirement, which brings all the trappings of public outreach and CEQA.
Thank you.
Other questions? Commissioner O'Grady? Commissioner Melska?
I just had a quick one. How do you measure the 80%? How would you, would you measure it? By number of materials or by volume or what?
Staff envisioned it as a condition requirement for these operations. As Commissioner White mentioned, the meeting the 80% extraction on-site extraction requirement would in and of itself trigger a discretionary land use permit, where staff would have the ability to bring forward this requirement, which we could basically make a condition.
Yeah, but how do you... If you need 10 materials, 8 of them have to come from the site by volume or by weight, or how do you measure it?
So that's recommending a percentage by volume of the finished product.
Oh, by volume.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
I have that same question, and if we do choose to go there with this 80-20 or some such thing, I think we will want to clarify that, mm-hmm. So that's something we will want to discuss if this is the direction we're looking to go, to make sure that's clearly written in. Other questions? Commissioner O'Grady?
Yes. I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch the Ag Department representative's name. Kanicki. Okay. She alluded to some history, and I wondered if staff had research records on the development of this particular standard here, and if so, what did you find?
Yeah, we staff had met with department management to come up with that. We were hard pressed to come up with a recollection of when this was adopted in the ordinance and what the original intent is, which is pretty much why we're here today. The language in the ordinance as it stands and as was adopted leaves out any type of quantifiable words like all or most or some or, you know, any type of that language. Staff feels that because the ordinance identifies these uses as allowable with these conditions, that it was the intent that they in some form be allowed, but we don't have the internal memory of when this was adopted and what was the original intent, other than what we interpret here today.
Madam Chair, if Commissioner O'Grady was also referring to Linda's comments about the Ag Preserve Review Committee's discussion of this use as a compatible use on Williamson Act contracted land, I can provide you a little more information on that. I didn't know if that's what you were driving at.
Only peripherally, if that information that you have is germane to the development of this Note 6, then I'd be interested in hearing what it says.
Okay. I have to give you a little background. The Ag Preserve program regulates or provides an opportunity for landowners to voluntarily enter into Williamson Act contracts on their property, which provides them with a lower property tax assessment in return for keeping their properties in larger parcel sizes and in ag uses over a 10 to 20 year period that is self-perpetuating if allowed to just let run. And so it's not really zoning. It's an incentive program. And the intent of the rules of procedure is to make sure that the property that comes into the program is worth the preferential tax treatment that it gets. And in the rules of procedure, there is a list of uses that is very much like Table 2-2 in the Land Use Ordinance, but we call it Table 2 in the Ag Preserve Rules of Procedure. And it identifies the agricultural and compatible under zoning may not be appropriate or may require additional review on contracted land because of the extra benefit that the landowner receives and the extra public interest in making sure that is deserved. So we went through each of these line by line, and we also looked at the land use ordinance requirements. When we got to paving materials, staff's initial reaction was maybe this isn't appropriate. But after looking at the footnote, when it said materials must be extracted on site, the review committee decided, well, this is pretty limiting and probably doesn't represent a major issue because there won't be that many opportunities to do this. And so it didn't make it a no on Table 2, meaning it's not a compatible use. What it did instead was say it's a compatible use with a footnote 4. And the footnote 4 requires that each individual proposal go before the committee for a specific review as to whether it's compatible based on its site, its location, its scope, and scale. So the committee reached that conclusion, and what Ms. Akinicki was pointing out was that was based on the understanding at that time that all materials be extracted on site. So that's the background to that. What you have before you today, you can look at it in a couple of different ways. Yes, it's the same footnote. It does apply to the ag category. It also applies to other uses in the ag category, like stone and cut stone products, as Commissioner White was bringing up. Your commission can look at this in a couple of different ways. You can say your interpretation today is only for these uses in the rural lands category. If you do that, then the implications for the Ag Preserve rules is moot because these properties are going to be in the Ag Land Use category.
Mr. Hogue, so that brings out one of my lingering questions here is, why are we separating out, and there's some controversy over separating out or what we're doing today, rural lands and ag lands. We're hearing Ms. Akinicki say this would have an effect on ag lands, and we're hearing planning staff suggest that we're only looking at rural lands. The disconnect?
I'll give you my favorite answer that I give sometimes to these kinds of questions. It depends.
Okay.
And
not what we want to hear.
The reason why you're being asked about rural lands today is because the question came up because of a project that is
on rural lands.
On rural lands.
Okay.
Okay. So that's why you're being asked the question about rural lands.
Okay.
So, but the same footnote applies to the ag category.
If the decision were made for one, it would be a logical conclusion
it could
get made for the other. But we wouldn't actually be doing that here today.
Maybe. That's up to your commission.
So we can decide that whether we wanted to go that route.
Well, first, do you want to do it at all?
Okay. And whether we
want it. Do you want it only to apply to rural lands? Third, do you want to say that it also applies to the other land use categories that has the footnote, which really is just ag? If you were to do that, it's still for land under contract would ultimately still go to the Ag Preserve Review Committee. And they would make a recommendation that would have to be considered by the review authority on the land use permit as to whether it's a compatible use based on the specific circumstances. And if it were a large operation, my guess would be the committee would not recommend that it's a compatible use.
Right. Okay.
So I don't want your commission to necessarily limit yourself based on this, but Ms. Akinicki was absolutely correct. The reason why the committee didn't call it an incompatible use is because all the materials were extracted on site.
Okay, got it. Thank you, Mr. Hogue. I think
Mr. Hogue, at what point does an interpretation become a revision or an amendment to the ordinance?
It really doesn't. It's adopted by, first of all, your recommendation is adopted by resolution that's sent to the Board of Supervisors. The Board of Supervisors then makes the final interpretation and adopts it by resolution. It, in and of itself, is not an ordinance amendment, but it's direction to staff of how to implement that ordinance. It could lead to further discussion to an actual ordinance amendment later, but that's a separate process. I don't know, Council, do you want to chime in on my explanation?
Tim McNulty with the County Council's office. I think the answer to your question is something like you exceed the ability to interpret something when you exceeded the bounds of the flexibility of the words in the English language that you're trying to use to do that. And I'm not being facetious at all. I think the way the court would look at it is there really any logical way to read the language the way you've read it in your interpretation? And if there is, and it supports a government...
Thanks. We'll consider that then. Other questions? I had just one more, then. It's on necessity and kind of public purpose. The suggestion from what we've read is this would water down, you know, what's now maybe an intent of 100%. Could you explain if there's some kind of necessity or public purpose in this, or making it 20%, or is there a shortage of industrial space for this?
And it was brought up earlier that this question came out of staff's review of a recent submittal of an application for a new hard rock mine in the North County. A portion of that application includes the proposed asphalt production as well. This is on rural lands, so it begged this question, and staff wanted to, or was thinking it was best to clarify that before we move into the permitting process for that project. So that's where in part comes from, and also after taking a look at this issue, it seems that for asphalt production in particular, a 100% requirement would artificially limit that use to only those that can extract the oil and refine it on site, and it was felt that although it's listed as an allowable use in the ordinance, that 100% requirement would in effect put an insurmountable limit on that use in rural lands.
Right, but my question is then, it's still an allowed use in industrial and possibly some other zone.
Sure.
So do we have a shortage of industrial space, or do we have some public purpose in spreading out the production of this to rural lands that somehow serves the public or cuts down on transportation trips or some such thing?
Outside of the general benefit of the local production of building materials, I would probably have to defer that to the to our industry representatives and the applicant to talk about whether or not this material is in short supply in the county. Staff doesn't have a good handle on whether it's the supply and demand issue behind whether or not there is a general shortage in the building community, but other than that, it's a general support for the local production of these goods.
Okay, but you can't comment on the shortage of industrially zoned land.
I can only speculate, yeah.
Well, okay. To follow up on that point, which is a good one, Mr. Marshall's a customer of this product, so maybe he could weigh in.
Do you have a hard time getting this stuff for your roads, Mr. Marshall?
Glenn Marshall, County Public Works. I hate to respond right now. Before, about 2 or 3 years ago, we were having a hard time getting the product, but the economy has changed significantly, so I defer to the applicant or the representatives.
Okay. Thank you. If there are no other questions for staff, we'll take a break and come back at 10:45 and hear from the public on this matter. We will reconvene this regular meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission. If everyone will come back to it, if you need any side discussions, call out. Thanks. So we finished questions for staff, and we'll open up public comment on item 2, this request for interpretation. And first of all, we have Aaron Arlen Janae here from the Air Pollution Control District. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, Erin Arlen-Janae. I'm the manager of the Planning and the Outreach Division for the Air Pollution Control District. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today on staff's recommendation for interpretation of allowances on rural lands. We support the comments that the Department of Agriculture presented to you during the staff presentation. We are concerned with the last two recommendations that are included in the proposal today. We feel, the Air Pollution Control District feels, that as the ordinance is currently structured, it is clear on what materials can be used and limiting those to on-site as it reads, and opening that up into an interpretation for 20% out in rural lands, and for that matter even on the ag lands, has some significant air quality implications that your board needs to consider prior to making any recommendations onto the Board of Supervisors. We're unclear where the 20% came from and what that means for asphalt batch plants, but the siting of industrial sources like an asphalt batch plant in rural lands can bring in additional truck trips into the area, as well as different process units, different types of air contaminants that may be surrounded by land uses sensitive receptors that were not intended. Land uses in rural lands be limited to those operations that extract raw materials on site and not expand it to some certain percentage of off-site importation. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have David Blakely, and after that, on the other podium, please, Dorothy Jennings. Mr. Blakely, welcome.
Good morning. I'm Dave Blakely from Santa Margarita, and I'd like to, first of all, welcome, a belated welcome to Commissioner O'Grady. I know you've got some very big shoes to fill, but I know you're going to do a great job representing the people of the 5th District and the entire county. Serving on the Planning Commission, so thank you for stepping up to the plate. As I was thinking about this issue this morning, I had what I'm calling my Bill Clinton moment. And it depends on what the meaning of the word is. And I think that's what this is kind of getting down to. Mr. McNulty talked about what the meaning of raw materials is, and then we're talking about what all the materials are. And it just reminded me of Bill Clinton when he was talking to the grand jury back in 1998. The pertinent language you're being asked to interpret is the allowable use is limited to manufacturing operations for which the raw materials are extracted on site. It seems very clear to me. So I struggled to understand how the staff could require the interpretation. The land use ordinance, I believe, is not silent on this issue. In Table 2.2, it talks about the requirement, and the requirement to me means that the materials need to come from on site. You can get into the argument Mr. McNulty talked about earlier, what the meaning of raw material is. And I believe my interpretation would be the raw materials are any materials that go into the production of a finished material. So it wouldn't be just oil out of the ground. It could be processed oil that is brought in, as it considered to me, to be a raw material of the finished manufacturing product. I think also it was illustrated that you're going to run into some problems if you just focus on the rural lands, because the notation talks about rural and ag lands, and if you separate them out, I believe you're going to run into some problems in terms of amending the land use ordinance. And I think it's in there for a very good reason. I believe that if you look at a map of the county, there's a lot of rural and ag land in the county, and I haven't found one person that lives in a rural or ag area that thinks it would be a great idea to have one of these processing plants in the ranch or piece of property next door to them. I know it'd be kind of like living in the city and being in favor of a frat house being next door to you. The smell, the traffic, the noise is not something that I think people find to be very desirable. Think about it a minute. I don't think any of you would like to live close to one of these. I believe that there is a process that you can use if you do, in fact, want to change this, and that would be to go through a general plan amendment. That way you'll be able to look at all of the potential impacts of this proposed change or this interpretation, and I don't think the interpretation method is the proper way. If you want to change it, go through a general plan amendment like anybody else. They can look at the traffic, look at the odor, look at the noise, look at the impacts in the area, make sure that all the constituencies are able to weigh in on the issue and do it that way. It wouldn't be appropriate to do it today, and I think the interpretation is all the material should be on site. Thank you,
sir. Dorothy Jennings, and next up would be Susan Harvey.
I'm Dorothy Jennings, speaking for North County Watch. Your discussion today should not be limited to Table 2.2. I would like to speak to an ordinance not discussed in staff report. That is your open space zoning ordinance, 22.01040. That ordinance covers ag and rural lands, including ag land under Williamson contract, of which Warren Hogue spoke. Not allowing the importation of raw materials is consistent with your own open space zoning because it refers to state government code. State statute 65560 limits open space land to the management of areas containing major mineral deposits. Therefore, raw materials may not be imported onto ag or rural lands engaged in mining or quarrying for the purposes of developing commercial products.
Thank you. Susan Harvey and David Arndt.
Good morning. Susan Harvey speaking for North County Watch, and thank you for the opportunity to address you on this issue. There are a few things I'd like to talk about that came up during the earlier discussion. One of the things, and there may be, as they call an industry expert in the audience that can speak more to this also, but when I was doing some research on this and when I was looking at the application that the applicant has filed, what asphalt production isn't what you see, well, it is what you see put on the ground, but you take your gravel and you take this thing called asphaltic oil, which has components to it. It's not like oil that comes out of the ground. Small scale manufacturing, it definitely ties ag and rural lands together there, as do many of the other sections in Title 22. I mean, they're kind of like, you know, this when they're, so if you were going to try to separate that in this discussion or in your decision, I think you'd be causing a lot of problems. And the issue here we're talking about, of course, is, you know, as I've come across in our Title 22, a large size inconsistency. And I believe that when you're dealing with some kind of inconsistency on this level, your best course is to go with the most restrictive definition, because you're least likely to cause, unintended consequences down the road, too. Also, and I'm glad that Aaron Arlen Janae was able to talk about where asphalt is being done now on industrial sites. The only, what I know of is the one on Union Asphalt, and I looked that site up in Paso, and it is indeed on an industrial site, surrounded by industrial sites. And then, of course, in Nipomo, that general plan amendment came through in 2008, I believe, to change commercial services and residential lands residential rural to industrial for the purpose of siting asphalt. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Harvey. David Arntz, followed by Ken Johnston at the other podium, please. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. I'm here speaking in part for Santa Margarita area residents together, SMART. I would just like to reinforce what we said in our letter, that we feel that changing the language for a project like this is risky and it could have long-term impacts that we feel would not benefit the county. Any applicant who wants to do this on their land can, and they're not zoned industrial, can apply for a change of zoning so that they will be in industrial. If it fits, that's fine, but we feel that allowing this additional importation of materials into rural lands or ag lands is the wrong direction. Thank you all very much.
Mr. Arndt, you are here representing Santa Margarita Area Advisory Council, correct?
No.
Oh, you're not?
SMART, Santa Margarita Area Residents Together.
Okay, SMART versus SMAC. Okay,
yes.
Got it, distinction. Thank
you.
Next up, we have Ken Johnston, and after that, Floyd, take a guess. Lamnum, maybe?
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Ken Johnston. I have been in the construction materials industry since 1980. And at some point, if you would like an explanation on how asphalt is produced, I will be happy to do a presentation for you. I don't have enough time today.
If you wanted to correct the previous layman summary.
Expand on it, and she got quite a bit of it right, but there's a lot more involved in it. I wanted to speak on a couple of different things. SP6, it was mentioned earlier that it involves concrete and plaster production as well on other lands. The raw materials is only a portion of concrete. Asphalt, the same thing. Asphalt pavement, you need to have a finished product as a binder or glue to bring it all together to make the material. So by saying the raw materials, 100% of the raw materials have to be extracted on site, bringing in asphalt to a site to where the raw materials are being produced is the lesser impact than taking the raw materials, the aggregates, to another site and importing 100% of the materials to that other site. You reduce the impact on the roads and air quality and such. that was basically the only points that I had to to make today.
I've got a question, Mr. Johnson, if you don't mind. Would you say that it's possible to create any of these products under the SP6 with all materials taken from the site? Does any site that you know of contain everything you would need to produce these products?
These products being paving materials?
The asphalt paving materials or the concrete gypsum plaster products, stone and cut stone products, structural clay and pottery related products. Those are the four that are listed under this SP6 in rural lands and agriculture.
Stone and cut stone, yes, you could produce 100%. All of the others require something to be brought in to be added to the raw materials that you extract on site.
That was my suspicion, that it would take some sort of chemical ingredients to manufacture these other products.
Yes, and asphalt oils for asphalt paving production is produced at oil refineries. We have one in this county. However, they do not produce asphalt oil. They refine to a dry carbon and then export that
out and make the asphalt elsewhere. I guess I'm not clear on how that could be the case unless the asphalt was all used on site, but presumably you would be shipping the finished asphalt out to various places where it would be used. So perhaps you could elaborate and explain how that's a lesser impact.
Certainly. I'll take a project that is ongoing in San Luis Obispo County now, the Nacimiento Waterline Project. It skirted behind the town of Santa Margarita, but it came down El Camino Real from south of Tascadero. The road had to be dug up and the pipeline put in the ground, and then it had to be repaved where the damage was done to the roadway. The aggregate for that particular job came from the Rocky Canyon Quarry, which is in behind the state hospital in Atascadero, which is at the north end of a very large, high-quality granite deposit. That rock was trucked up to Paso Robles to the Union Asphalt, now Cal Portland, owned by Cal Portland Cement, asphalt plant. It was mixed with liquid asphalt that was trucked down from Richmond and then hauled back down to El Camino Real. So the impacts there, the large percentage of the asphalt finished product actually drove by itself. It went back and forth on Highway 101. So that's one case in particular. That particular asphalt plant is sitting on an old aggregate mine site. So they were mining aggregate there and built a ready-mix plant and an asphalt plant on that site many years ago, and it mined out, and they went to importing their raw material.
Thank you. Other questions?
One more question about the recycling of asphalt that perhaps has been scarified off of existing pavement. How would that fit into this complex equation that we're developing here? Does that come on site or the sites that we're talking about, or does that go somewhere else and get mixed elsewhere? Maybe you could elaborate on that.
During the production of asphalt pavement, you can add many different constituents. Liquid asphalt is needed. Recycled asphalt pavement that has been ground off the roads, it's commonly known as a wrap, can be added to the material. It takes up a certain percentage. In some areas of the country, New England, they're doing 65% recycled. Caltrans in the state of California will allow you to add 15% by weight recycled asphalt pavement when you're producing asphalt.
So it really depends on the customer and his specification for the asphalt insofar as what percentage of recyclables or wrap, did you say?
Yes.
Yeah, wrap. And it would be sellable, right? So to try to specify a percentage of materials that would off-site materials that would be allowable to be brought on-site in the production of asphalt. I mean, how could you do that if the specifications vary as widely as you just said?
Well, in the you would end up with manufacturing facilities that can't supply to the customer. In San Luis Obispo County, there is one facility that does now use recycled asphalt, and that's the Cal Portland facility. Hansen Materials do not use recycled in their asphalt production.
And while we're on that, then, a follow-up. So you said 15% recycled material max, and then would that be plus the 20% input of oil?
Well,
would that take it over possibly the 20% that we're talking about with the staff recommendation?
The staff recommendation of 20% would mean a combination of recycled and liquid. Liquid asphalt is a component of the total mix, and this is where 3 minutes isn't enough time. If you make asphalt, when you're constructing a road, you want to build a structural section, and you start with large. We are the last bastion. We fight so that we don't conform to what the federal specifications are for asphalt. So we're behind the curve.
What does that mean, being behind the curve? I don't know. That means we're ahead of things, or we're...
Well, we're behind the curve in the...
Is behind that curve.
Yeah. Asphalt paving products have been used for thousands of years. But we in California aren't grasping the newest technology. And that happens because we're a large market and we have a very good highways department in Caltrans, and they've got a lot of test data. Well, other states have grasped the recycled asphalt where you can be 25, 30, 40, 50% for state projects. There are states like Texas who have grasped warm mix asphalt, which means you can lower the production temperature of your asphalt, which cuts down on how much heat you have to produce to make the material. So
okay.
The fact that I'm getting a little bit off, but the 20% covers what is existing in the state now.
General use. Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Unless there are more questions, will you be able to stay with us for the rest of this discussion? There may
Absolutely.
Be some more questions you'd be best to answer. Thank you. Next up, we have Floyd Landham, and then on the deck, Eric Greening.
Thank you for listening to me. I've actually never spoken here before, and I speak for myself. I am a resident that lives near this proposed project, and I have some concerns about it. But one of the things that I wanted to say that I want to kind of bring us back to on this is that I think the focus is that when a property or a parcel is zoned rural lands, that if somebody wants to engage in this type of business, that the products must originate on site. And so I just wanted to kind of bring that back to focus, and that the asphalt recycling is going to require to have this material brought in, and that so it's not originating on site. I also wanted to get maybe some clarifications from the staff. I believe the applicant is also applying for concrete manufacturing and recycling as well. And wouldn't this also apply to that, since that material would also have to be brought in?
Mr. Landham, just to, before we take more time, we're not looking at the specific project yet. So whether staff could answer those questions or not, we don't want to get too far forward on this. We're just asking the very specific preliminary question about interpreting this definition. So if you will, keep your questions limited to that.
Okay, and going in that direction then, my question again would be, if we're interpreting this as asphalt recycling, would this also not apply to concrete recycling as well? So to limit it there. I would also like to say that where I live is probably about a quarter of a mile from this place, and my understanding is that there is also a Union Oil facility very near this place, and I actually have a complaint with Air Pollution Control Board open now regarding the fumes from that facility. And so I hear you keep mentioning Paso Robles and the Union Oil facility, but there is one very close in South Atascadero also. I'd also like to say that to mention what you had mentioned before, would there be a transportation benefit for this? And I don't see that this project is in far South County or far North County, so it's very close to the existing Union facility, so I'm not sure that there would be a benefit for the transportation issue as well. So, thank you.
Mr. Lehman, while you're here, you've mentioned the Union Oil facility that you've had some issues with. At what distance is that from your residence?
Well, that from as the crow flies is probably maybe no more than 2 miles.
Something like 2 miles. Okay, are there any questions for Mr. Lehman? Okay, thank you for coming today. Mr. Greening, and after that, last speaker slip I have is Michael Wynn. If anyone else would like to speak to this, please do get us a speaker slip and we'll add you on.
Thank you.
Mr. Greening?
I'm Eric Greening, and I would strongly urge that when you're making an interpretation, you do so as conservatively as possible, because you do not do CEQA on interpretations. If you're going to create new policy on an interpretation, it needs to be evaluated. And we've heard discussions about what might be a greater or lesser impact, as if you were trying to come to CEQA-type conclusions. And obviously, you don't have the process in front. The extent of the demand for some of these materials could break a huge issue of policy ground. I think I've discussed before, and I think I may have even gotten a copy to some of you, of a letter that the Council of Governments received from Caltrans last year, basically saying, this county is not doing enough to produce the level of material we need for our projects in your county, which is why we're hauling it in from other places, and that the impacts of that are greater than digging it up in your own county. I think that can be argued back and forth again, and it certainly speaks to the need to be dead serious about modal shift in transportation so that we're not continuing to grow the road surface in this county, which does have a huge local impact. But what I am saying here is that this little question of interpretation, if that means anything besides all of the, you basically should be rewriting the ordinance to say that rather than interpreting it so that you can do CEQA on the ordinance. But I think the best policy is what Mr. Blakely suggested, which is if you're going to put an industrial use on your land, you should be here with the general plan amendment if you're not already industrial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. I know, Mr. Wynn, you're not going to pass up the opportunity to comment on close enough for government work. Yeah, welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Wyatt and Commissioners. My name is Mike Wynn. I'm from Napomo, and I'm chair of the RAC. Just a few very brief comments. Other than as a professional grammarian to wholeheartedly support Mr. Greening's notions about how the English language works. I think you have a problem here today, and I don't think an interpretation solves the problem. The problem is that we really do need road base in this county. Gravel and sand are highly important. Recycling is a good idea, must be supported every way we can. All of these are common sense. The problem is the ordinance doesn't support the common sense businesses that need it. The ordinance simply says what it says. It doesn't need an interpretation. What you're really being asked to do is to change the ordinance and call it an interpretation. Procedurally, and just to make the thing right for future users as well, I think you're much better off to simply say, we understand the ordinance. There's no variation of what we understand it. It's defective. Let's do a general plan amendment and let's repair the defect and look at what that repair is going to cost us. That's my suggestion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wynn. Anyone else like to comment on this item? So seeing no one and having no speaker slips, we'll bring it back to staff to respond to public comment.
Sure. Thank you. And the bulk of what staff understands from public comments today was that they were just that, comments. We didn't pull a lot of questions out of there, except for an interesting question about where staff got the 20% recommendation for imported materials. That came from discussions with Mr. Johnson and other industry representatives, and is meant to cover mainly the need for importing petroleum for asphalt production, but also addresses the need for some recycled asphalt in that mix, even though there's, I believe, only one operation in the county that's doing that. And it sounds like Mr. Johnson was able to confirm that that number captures the industry need for asphalt production. There was an interesting comment before our break bringing up the definition of raw materials, and in particular what the word raw means. And it basically, when you look at the dictionary, raw means unprocessed. So we could today move away from a numeric quantifier by interpreting the word raw as it's used in the ordinance and in this footnote. So if we take the word raw to mean, as it's said in the dictionary, unprocessed, we could exclude things like petroleum products or processed recycled asphalt outside of the definition of raw. And if we use the definition of unprocessed, what we're really talking about is the mined, extracted materials, mainly the aggregate sand and gravel.
Both the applicant and the staff are bringing this issue up early as opposed to bringing it up late, because it is really, I'm sure, very upsetting not only for the staff and the applicant to put all that money and time into it, but it's certainly upsetting for the Planning Commission to deal with those kinds of applications at the end of the process rather than the beginning. So I appreciate this opportunity here. I also want to just kind of come back to you and the comments you just made, Mr. Oliveira, and address the comment made by County Council, and that is, yes, we could start talking about raw materials and what the dictionary definition is versus the legal definition versus the intended definition versus the common understanding definition, but I got to say that that kind of manipulation and legal wrangling of definitions and interpretations is exactly what people off when they're talking about government and lawyers and all the way. This is just not the way to make law and not the way to communicate with your public. So let's just not go there. I would just beg you, let's not go there. I'm going to just say right up front that I am not going to support the staff's recommendation today. I do believe, as Mr. Greening and Mr. Wynn so well summed up, that I don't think this is a good way to make law. I don't think this is a good way to change the ordinance. I'm not against the production of asphalt in our county for use on our county roads. I agree that that's a good idea. But I don't really see the difference between trucking petroleum products back and forth and trucking raw materials back and forth. You're trucking stuff back and forth, and I just think that the basic ordinance is what it is, and it says what it means to say, which is that if you're going to be doing stuff like extracting gravel and that kind of thing and then making something, whatever you're making has to come from what you just extracted, not from stuff you bring in. And I think interpreting that as meaning 80% of that is not what we want to do here. And I think it means what it says. And it says you need to just use raw materials. And that's not what this future applicant has in mind. And that's why I appreciate the opportunity to speak right now. We need more asphalt in this county. I mean, I'm trying to get my driveway asphalted and there isn't any asphalt. So we need more asphalt, but I think trying to jury-rig some kind of way to get it, get a plant out in this area in rural lands is not only not what was intended by this ordinance, but it sets dangerous precedences in terms of interpretation, and certainly we've heard from several other county departments that show other reasons not to go there. So I'm not going to go there, personally.
Okay. And on the other side...
I'm ready to respond to that, because I agree with a lot of what Commissioner Christensen has said, but where I really disagree is that I'm trying to be intellectually honest here to interpret what this ordinance intent was. And I believe it was intended for raw materials to be defined, as Mr. McNulty and Mr. Oliveira pointed out. And maybe it's antiquated. Maybe it's not a good idea anymore, but to be intellectually honest, I believe that was the intent when the ordinance was written. But again, I don't think it's, in most cases, it's probably not a good idea for these types of facilities to be on those properties. So if I have to make strictly an interpretation, I'm going to interpret it that way. But with the caveat that I think there should be a higher level of review, and any applicant that goes down that road needs to understand that it may be a dead end. And I've been one that spoke out this last year, as Ms. Kennedy pointed out, that, you know, and as Mr. Nalwell knows, that I really don't like to see an applicant go down a dead end road. So today I think we're just being asked to make an interpretation, and I believe that was the intent, because it's impossible to pull 100% of all ingredients to manufacture this. You manufacture anything, any type of manufacturing, the pottery, the gypsum, it all takes chemical ingredients. And so, again, I don't think that's a good idea, and it's probably antiquated, but if we're just making the interpretation, I think hopefully the board will move for an amendment to the ordinance. So that's where I'm coming down on it. And
excuse me, Commissioner White. So I'm hearing two different things, and I'm not sure which you mean. Do you mean that you're suggesting we would recommend not making this interpretation or calling it to be 100%, or that you're suggesting we would also recommend, as some members of the public have, that this not be handled as an interpretation and that we would recommend a GPA amendment if something other than 100%? Requirement is the way we want it.
Well, I have one question before I answer your question, and that was theoretically, and it's probably not a theory, it probably exists. There's existing sites out there that are permitted to extract what I consider the raw materials as indicated in the way I interpret the ordinance. Would they just need to come in, if they wanted to increase that use to a manufacturing of asphalt, would they just be able to come in with a site plan and say, hey, now we want to haul in the chemicals to the petroleum products to make the asphalt?
Any operation that's extracting these raw materials right now, Baymation plan, our ordinance is clear on that. The revision to a reclamation plan triggers a minor use permit, which brings you in for land use permit and CEQA.
And would that entail a public hearing?
That's right.
Because Mr. Blakely spoke to that increased use could trigger odor and more truck trips and that type of thing.
And CEQA would apply as well.
So again, I may not like it. I may not like what this ordinance allows, but if I have to make an intellectually honest interpretation, that interpretation is the intent at the antiquated time that it was written was to extract just the raw materials, which are what you can take out of the land, and any ingredients to compound those materials, such as chemicals for pottery or oil for asphalt, was not part of that. So I don't like the 20%. I think it's clear that it's limited to manufacturing operations for which the raw materials are extracted on site. So I think Mr. McNulty nailed it. The qualifier and the clarifying word to me is the raw materials. So I still think we should maintain 100% raw materials. If I have to interpret this ordinance, 100% raw materials under my definition coming from site, and refined materials, which could be glue or chemicals or whatever, would have to come from offsite.
Okay, and there would be no limit then under your interpretation on those processed.
Well, that's the way I interpret this. Like I said, with a caveat that I may not like it, but I'm trying to be honest with myself and the public here, and I do believe it's an antiquated ordinance and it needs to be looked at for all the reasons that Ms. Kennedy and Aaron from APCD stated. But if I'm being asked to make an interpretation, I have to be honest with myself,
that's
the way I interpret it.
Okay, so you wouldn't see a need then to carry on with the 80-20 conversation because of that interpretation of raw.
Yeah,
so if we were trying to go there, we wouldn't need to follow up on the 80-20. Okay, so we've heard from you.
Just to follow up, I am somewhat comforted by what Mr. Oliveira just said, that any increase in use of these existing mines out there would trigger a public hearing where they may not be allowed and probably would not be for all the reasons that the public spoke here today. But again, I hate to sound so repetitive, but I have to be honest with myself. And Mr. Blakely spoke to, you know,
we're all being pretty honest.
Definition of business.
No, but I mean, we're all being honest. We know you're being honest.
I think we heard that idea.
But you made a compelling argument that my position would not be honest. That we're trying to go through gyrations to make something.
Well, I wasn't really talking about you because we didn't hear
Drew. I know that.
Just talking about.
I think we have a question before us here today, and it's not clear, and there are obviously differing opinions. So we would expect that to be reflected most likely here today, as there have been amongst staff and applicants and public already. So I think we can respect those differing ideas on it.
Well, Madam Chair, and I would like to respond to what was just said. Let's remember why we're here today. This is an interpretation of the ordinance. Staff isn't attempting to jerry-rig the ordinance or change the ordinance in this fashion. We have an applicant that sat through a pre-application meeting and was told certain things, and we have an applicant that has agreed to do an environmental impact report that will cost a lot of money and take at least a year to do. It's only fair that we get this question out of the way up front and not wait until the end of that EIR process and then explain to the applicant that, in fact, this importation is not allowed.
I think we're clear on that, and grateful to
be clear from staff why we're here and what we're doing. Thank you very much.
I think we are indeed all very grateful for that and glad to be doing this up front, as Commissioner Christensen said. That there isn't any question of that. Let's hear from Commissioner O'Grady. We have two differing interpretations here before us. You want to add a third or join in with one that's
been stated? Oh, certainly not. I do not want to add a third.
Okay, good news.
I would like to deal with what's being recommended first. And as I understand, what staff is recommending has nothing to do with changing the definition of raw materials. What it has to do with is establishing a maximum allowable content for imported raw materials. And staff's recommendation uses the same language of extracting raw materials on site as it does for importing raw materials. That means, in staff's eyes, the processed or refined petroleum product binders necessary for making asphalt fall in the same category as raw materials that are extracted on the site. And so I believe that the language that is in note 6 is very clear, that it means all paving materials. And I think about what I perceive as the impracticality of extracting or having all of the raw materials, such as creosote, which is mentioned specifically in the definition, of originating on site. And so I conclude that there's a conflict there between the note and the definition, that the ordinance is defective. I also would like to comment that I think, I asked about his historical background. If staff was able to find any historical background so that I could get some idea of the intent. Well, the answer was no, we didn't find any, so I don't know what to believe about the intent. So I'm drawing absolutely no conclusions about what the intent was because I do not know. So all I can do is deal with what's on the table right now. I think a good ordinance... When you're dealing with manufactured products, needs to deal with the reality of the marketplace. And this is another area where I believe this ordinance is defective.
And I think any a proposed solution to establish a fixed percentage of any component of the asphalt is also flawed, because I think the marketplace changes over time, and any sensible ordinance needs to recognize that. And in my opinion, an interpretation does not accomplish that objective. It's impossible. I agree that I think, as I just implied, that an interpretation really does have limitations. I concur it should not result in significant policy changes, and I conclude that the proper mechanism for dealing with this would be a general plan amendment, so that all stakeholders can weigh in, and we can come up with a very successful revised ordinance that will stand the test of time.
So would that be a suggestion then, not to weigh in on this interpretation? Maybe that goes to council. If we wanted to go the route of recommending a GPA as the mechanism to handle this, would we not make an interpretation? Or
wait a minute. I'm not ready to make a recommendation of how it should be handled. I want to go straight to what Mr. Nall said, whether or not we want to interpret it as staff has said. And no, I don't want to follow staff's recommendation. I want to say the ordinance is as it stands. It means 100% of raw materials. That's it. Then staff and or applicant and or the board or somebody else can go and decide how they want to make the next steps. I'm not willing to even start there because I don't have the information.
And that's all that staff is looking for. I think that
just
when the applicant gets the word on this, then they may decide to pursue a general plan amendment. Let's remember, a general plan amendment is going to require CEQA, and something like this may also trigger an environmental impact report, which would probably be most appropriately paid for by the applicant that pursues something like that.
Okay, so that's not something that you would be comfortable with the commission somehow recommending or building in, even though I've heard two commissioners suggesting that's an interest or would seem the proper way to pursue it. But I would suggest then, is this correct, that if that's the way the commission would be interested in going, that the route we might want to take is to make a strict 100% interpretation and then leave it to the applicant then with that interpretation to decide whether they would want to then pursue a GPA.
Well, you haven't heard from Mr. Mouse.
I'm just asking that question maybe to council, if that's indeed the way for that to happen, possibly.
Tim McNulty, it sounds to me like so far there aren't three votes to support the staff's interpretation of the ordinance. So I don't know, again, how the other two of you are going to vote, but if it remains that way, then I would say that the Planning Commission would recommend that it doesn't support the staff's interpretation of the ordinance, the 80%, 20% breakdown. Further, I think the Planning Commission can always recommend to the Board of Supervisors when it identifies some sort of internal conflict within the plans or policies that it's charged with evaluating, and recommend that some process be initiated to correct those things.
Okay. So that would be on the table as something we may want to do, or we may want to just leave to the applicant so we can get there. So, Commissioner Melskow, comments?
Yeah, I don't support the 20% because I don't think it solves anything. But I do agree that they need to look at what you mean by raw materials. And I kind of agree with that. Making asphalt
to make a recommendation on staff, suggestions. But that's it.
But no, it's
I'm
not.
I'm just not willing to go any. I'm just not. No, I'm not willing to say anything else. I mean, it could be. I'm saying that it could be that looking at the definition of raw materials is the way to go. But I'm not willing to say that's. I'm not willing to say yes or no. I think you're going way too far beyond our charge today.
Okay, well, let me weigh in there since I haven't weighed in yet, and hopefully then maybe we can proceed. I agree with the commissioners to my left, Commissioners White and Melskow, that there is some uncertainty as to raw, and it would seem from the definition, which has some materials such as asphalt and other stuff, that maybe there could be some distinction between raw material inputs and other inputs, but I think because it's not clear, just as you've said, and we haven't looked into this, that if there's any uncertainty, my leaning would be to go toward the more conservative definition, which is agreeing with Commissioner Christensen and possibly O'Grady, that given that we're not certain, we don't know what the intent was, we don't know what the meaning is on raw versus finished, that it would be in our best interest to have the conservative read and call that interpretation 100% of the material inputs.
Could I just add to that a little bit? We have this staff report that deals with changing the percentage and the possible implications of that, but we don't have a staff report that deals with the possible implications of changing the definition of raw materials. And from my experience in industry, for example, in the building industry, if you ask a contractor, what are the raw materials involved in constructing a high-rise office building? Well, there's piping, there's wiring, there's glazing, there's concrete. He's not talking sulfur, copper. It's all contextual, and I think there's mineral deposits, and talking about mining, those words could have been used if that was the intent. But as I said before, I don't have the history. I don't know. It's ambiguous, and we don't have enough information, in my opinion, to make a rational decision about coming down with a decision on an interpretation at this time.
So I'm hearing it sounds like three of us in support then what would our motion be then? But might we not want to add? Somebody want to second that for discussion?
I second that.
Okay, and for discussion purposes, then might we want to add some further detail to that?
Well, I would request the board to define raw materials, and I'm not trying to change the definition of raw materials. That's my interpretation of what raw materials are. And, you know, in manufacturing and construction, as you pointed out, are two different things. I think it's hard to manufacture almost anything without other ingredients besides the raw materials. But if all we're doing is rejecting staff's interpretation, I'm 100% on board with that because I didn't like the percentage either.
Okay, and so would the motion maker be comfortable, amenable then to adding some kind of request? Since this goes to the board, it's a recommendation to the board that they do look at that definition or clarifying?
No, I would like to.
Okay, as is.
Someone else wants to make another motion about something else. Sorry, I don't have my microphone on. If someone would like to make a motion about something else, then they're welcome to do so.
And we'll handle that separately. Okay, well,
that's
if you will,
like.
If the motion maker, if you will, please repeat your motion.
Oh, yes. I move that our commission deny the staff's definition of the ordinance.
Okay, and we have a second on that. The second maker is clear?
Yes, I second it.
Commissioner Mouskow. Okay, any further discussion on that motion before us? If the clerk will then please call the roll.
Commissioner O'Grady?
Yes.
Commissioner Mouskow?
Yes.
Commissioner Christensen?
Yes.
Commissioner Wyatt?
Yes.
Chairperson Wyatt?
Yes. And with that, would anyone like to make a further motion, such as that the board look at raw materials or some other piece of this as a follow-up?
Yes, I'd like to make a motion that the board review this to determine whether it was a... if we have a defect in the ordinance or if the intent was to define raw materials as those that could be extracted on site.
Do you have a second for that motion? Okay, I'm not hearing a second. Any other motion? Do you want to try with something close to that? Anyone else?
I'll make a motion that we also ask the board to define raw materials as used in SB 6 of the ordinance.
Okay, I'm not hearing a second on
county file number LRP 2008-00010, all supervisorial districts. Michael Conger, project manager.
Madam Chair, I'm John Nall. I'm your principal environmental specialist with the Department of Planning and Building. This is a scoping meeting. We're still under commission business now on the agenda. we're having a scoping meeting because we staff prepared an initial study for the proposed amendments to the ag cluster ordinance, and that initial study identified some potential significant impacts that could occur as a result of these proposed changes. According to the California Environmental Quality Act, when we look at something like this that has regional or countywide significance, CEQA dictates that we hold a scoping meeting prior to undertaking the preparation of an EIR. And really the purpose of the scoping meeting is to help us all get our arms around what the scope of the environmental impact report should be for these proposed amendments to the ag cluster ordinance. So that's just a little bit of background. Remember, we had the same thing just a couple of weeks ago on the Acceleron project, and I advised your commission to watch out what you say, don't show any bias. And as far as the audience goes, really what we're looking for are comments with regard to potential physical effects on the environment, potential mitigation measures that might come about through all of this, and also alternatives that could be discussed in the environmental impact report. So that's what we're doing for this last item of the day, and at this point, I'll turn it over to Mr. Michael Conger, one of our project managers on these ordinance changes. Michael?
Good morning, Chair Wyatt, members of the Commission. Michael Conger, County Planning Staff. I'm co-managing the environmental impact report on this project along with Erlyn Singwald, also in our office.
Mr. Conger, just before you start, please, sorry to interrupt, but how long is your staff report? How much time do you need?
We anticipate about 10 minutes.
About 10 minutes, okay. And are there members of the public who are here to speak to this item who can't come back after lunch? I had a feeling there might be. Mr. Conger, could you keep your staff report abbreviated so we could try to fit a couple commenters in before our noon break? If there's a way, we could come back with further questions or detail maybe after lunch.
And Madam Chair, let's remember that we need to adjourn before the stroke of noon or we get charged extra for the telecast.
Right, right. I'm just trying to fit in a few members of the public that I expect it'll be difficult for to wait over lunch.
I'll try to keep it abbreviated. Your commission's already had a few scoping meetings, so we'll skip on the process a little bit.
Thank you.
So the just an overview of the project that's being considered is amendment to the Agricultural Cluster Subdivision Ordinance and Policies. This includes details such as the qualifying locations for where agricultural cluster subdivisions can occur, as well as density and design of the cluster subdivisions. The project would also consider a change in residential density on existing legal agricultural designated parcels. Presently in the inland area, they're allowed 2 residences per parcel. The proposal would be to change that down to 1 residence per parcel, plus any qualifying farm support. The ordinance amendment process first starts with authorization from the Board of Supervisors. That's already occurred. The public review draft of the ordinance is in process. We already have a preliminary draft posted to our website. Then comes the environmental impact report process, and that will follow with a Planning Commission hearing where the Commission will make a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors, and the Board of Supervisors would also hold a public hearing. And so there's several opportunities for public comment throughout this process. Within the environmental impact report process, the first step is the notice of preparation. That's already been published, and that's available on our website as well. Today is the scoping meeting. This is the first opportunity for public comment on the environmental impact report. After this, we will be working on a draft environmental impact report. That will be released also for public comment. Those comments will be addressed in the final environmental impact report, and then public hearings would occur. The purpose of the scoping meeting is to provide an opportunity for any interested members of the public to provide comments on the environmental impact report before it gets written. So comments such as the scope of the environmental review, the content of the report, mitigation measures, alternatives are things we'd be looking for comments on today. Again, I'll get into the project description. There's 3 major components to this project. One would be reducing the residential density in the agricultural category, which affects existing parcels. The second component would be modifying the agricultural cluster subdivision ordinance based on board direction that we received last year. Subdivisions would qualify for the same number of parcels as a standard subdivision. And it would also require that cluster parcels be 2.5 acres minimum, which would affect density as they are limited to 5% of the site. As far as design goes, 2.5 acre cluster parcels would be required. The parcels would need to be physically contiguous, so there wouldn't be open area on the agricultural preserve parcel between the individual parcels. One contiguous cluster area would be allowed by default. A second contiguous cluster area would be allowable if it would avoid environmental impacts. And there's also some clarification language going into the ordinance, including the fact that buffers must be located on the residential parcel. You can't put your agricultural buffer on the agricultural parcel. And then also that road infrastructure, such as water systems, also counts towards the 5% developable area within an ag cluster. Within the coastal zone, we'd be looking to bring the same cluster program tweaked a little bit to fit the coastal zone requirements and bring that into the coastal zone land use ordinance. The density, however, would be based on legal underlying parcels, which is based on a comment that we received from the Coastal Commission during their previous considerations of an agricultural cluster subdivision in the coastal zone. Briefly, some of the EIR issues that we'll be touching on include ag resources, air quality. We'll also be looking to do a separate chapter specifically on greenhouse gases. Biological resources, cultural resources, geologic hazards, hydrology and water quality, noise, public services and utilities, traffic, visual resources, and water resources. As far as comments go, we will be posting documents on our website, slowplanning.org. There's a link on the front page to agricultural cluster and density program, and there's a comment form available there that anyone can submit comments on. We're asking that comments on the scoping of the environmental impact report be provided by the 19th of February. And just some topics to comment on would be the scope of the environmental impact report, any specific knowledge about environmental considerations in various areas of the county, methodology for analysis of any of the impact areas being considered, any potential alternatives, and any suggestions for mitigation measures. And the contacts on this project for the environmental impact report are myself and Erlen Singwald. The project manager on the ordinance and general plan amendments is Bill Robeson, and there's his contact information. We'll also be posting that to the website as well. And so that concludes my presentation.
Mr. Conger, thank you for speeding that along. If my fellows will indulge the members of the public, maybe we can get a few, hold our questions and get a few speakers in before lunch. We have 8 minutes. Are there some members of the public who would like to speak to this and can't come back after lunch? How many hands up? 3. So we have 8 minutes. So if you can each do it in 2 minutes, we will get you in. I see Mr. Blakely up. Come on up. And after that, we have 2 more speakers, 2 minutes each. And if you need more time, you're welcome to come back and join us after lunch and have the full 3 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dave Blakely from Santa Margarita, and I am very encouraged by the staff report. And after going through the cluster project on the Santa Margarita Ranch, really as a poster child of why you need to take a look at the ag cluster and make some changes. I'm going to change my hat right now because last night at the Santa Margarita Area Advisory Council, we had a discussion of this, and because I was coming down on the previous item, I was asked to carry a motion that was made last night to the Planning Commission in regards to one issue, and that issue had to do with the 2 primary residences on ag land. And that breaks down into really 2 components. One component is the land use ordinance, which allows 2 primary residences on ag land. And the second component would be the calculation that is used in the ag cluster. When you do calculate the number of parcels you get in the ag cluster, you base it on the fact that you get 2 primary residences on ag land, and that's used to calculate the number of parcels you get on the ag cluster. Well, the discussion we had last night did not surround the latter issue, did not surround the issue of how the calculation is done in the ag cluster ordinance, but we spent quite a bit of time talking about changes in the ordinance on 2 primary residences on ag zone land, separate from the ag cluster calculation. And the motion was made, which I am bringing to you from SMAC, that they support the maintenance of the two primary residences on ag land. Okay? Period. Didn't get into the calculation in the ag cluster. There was concern about that because I guess on the cover page of today's item, it talked about it in the report that you made, talked about the fact that you were not only going to get into the interpretation in the ag cluster, but you were going to get into the interpretation in the land use ordinance of those two primary residents. A lot of red flags went up, I guess, in the agricultural community. It's very genuine.
There's an issue there, and we don't understand this at all, as to why the requirement for the residential development to be served by on-site wells versus community systems, especially when you're making the parcels contiguous. And then finally, on page 25, there is the boxes on page 25 dealing with water are all checked insignificant impact, but the conclusion is that there is potential significant impacts. So I don't understand that either, but if, like I said, the biggest issue here, and a minimum, if you don't bifurcate the primary dwellings from the rest, we would ask that you mail out a notice to every property owner in this county telling them what you're doing, because they should have, this is mislabeled in our opinion, and most people are not paying attention to this. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Wynn, did you want to take 2 minutes now? We have exactly that, or come back after lunch. Okay, anyone else? 2 minutes left before a lunch break. So seeing no one else who can't come back after lunch, do we want to take 2 minutes of questions or just call for a lunch break?
I want to just make a quick
comment.
You know, I emailed Mr. Robertson some questions, and I don't know if they actually got to him because I guess Mr. Conger and Mr. Singwall are actually handling this part. But I do need some kind of more of a background about what is now and then what's changing, because I am not familiar with the ag cluster enough to really understand what the heck we're doing. And it sounds like we've, and I also had the questions about, I don't understand about the density reductions. I understand the reasons for the behind the design changes, but I'm not really getting what it is we're proposing here. So it was hard to talk about.
So could I suggest that staff take a note, not respond now, and be ready to come back and respond after lunch? Are there other general questions for staff so they can be ready after lunch?
Well, mine were mostly centered around the comments from Mr. Blakely and Mr. Caldwell about where I'm hearing from everybody. Literally, the guy that delivered my pizza the other day heard about taking of this secondary primary, and I was going to ask if we can pull it out of this deal because it's really... My concern...
Okay, let's hold off on concerns. Yeah. Questions now. We'll come back after lunch and deal with the scoping more. Remember, this is just scoping as well.
Right.
So
right.
We certainly will have questions, but let's not prejudge the issue and get into decision-making. Mr. Moskow, any comments for questions for staff? Not comments, but questions.
Mine was the reducing of the residential density on agriculture parcel. What is an agriculture parcel? Is it an assessor's parcel? Is it the certificate of compliance parcel? Or what? Because you call it different things as you go back in this ordinance, and I wasn't sure what you meant by agriculture parcel.
Okay, so we'll look for some clarification there after lunch. Commissioner O'Grady, some questions?
How was the pizza? Was it?
Okay. Okay, then. We'll break for lunch and come back to it at 1:30. Good afternoon, everyone. This regular meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission is reconvened. We are following up on item number 3, agricultural cluster subdivision scoping session. Thank you to Mr. Conger for his very abbreviated staff report before lunch. I appreciate you hurrying through that so we could get a little bit of public comment in before lunch. Commissioner Christensen has just one note here, and then we'll continue with questions or answers from staff.
Oh, I just wanted to follow up that Mr. Robertson actually did provide me with my information, just in case people were thinking badly of him, and I didn't recognize him out there in his new suave look. I didn't realize he was here to enlighten me. Thank you.
And we had a list of questions to staff before lunch, so maybe that be the time to come back, get some answers to those.
Sure. There was one question raised by Mr. Caldwell about the check boxes in the environmental determination or the initial study. on the water section, and they are incorrect. They're listed as potentially insignificant. They should be potentially significant. And we will be analyzing water resources in the environmental impact report, so I just wanted to clarify that, first of all.
And the reviewer of that initial study should have caught that, Madam Chairman, Chairperson, and I apologize for not catching it.
And let's see. We had a question about pulling out the second primary. To clarify on that, that was a part of the board's direction when the board authorized this for processing back in February of 2009. So we do need to consider it as part of the project description under this environmental impact report. I did want to point out that we will be considering an alternative that would not include that provision. And so when the ordinance goes through the process and is back before your commission, to make a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors, your commission can consider that as an alternative and recommend an alternative to...
Sure, that we do have a good, clear project description and alternative.
Okay, other questions?
Yes, I had a little confusion and clarification. A couple weeks ago when we were here, we were doing a scoping session on the rural area updates, and I asked specifically the question if zoning allowances or entitlements could be affected or were being looked at, because I'd heard about this removal of the secondary primary, and the staff that was at the table then said that was not part of anything on the table, but anything could be in the future. So I don't know if that's just some miscommunication. Because that evening I got home, the staff report was there and online, and boom, there it was. So I was a little bit confused about the miscommunication between staff on that.
Yeah, I can respond to that question. The land use and circulation element update is a separate process from this. This is related because it's another amendment package that is also, in a sense, implementing the county's adopted strategic growth principles, but it is a separate process as the land use and circulation element update.
Okay, and then to follow up on this, on page 3.3, we talk about reduced residential density on existing agricultural parcels, and it talks about removing the section from the LUO. Is this specific just to ag, or would other parcels, such as rural lands, that have those current entitlements be affected, or is this just for this specific?
This is specific to the agriculture designation.
And then it was a little bit unclear because on page 3.7, it says what will not be affected is the build-out of primary single-family residences on existing legal lots. So there's two primaries allowed now, but you're proposing, this seems conflicting with removing that. It's on the top of page 3-7 of our staff report, the first bullet point.
Yeah, that can be clarified. What we were trying to convey is that we're not considering the full build-out of all agricultural parcels and the impacts from those within this initial study. So the environmental impact report is not going to consider that every agricultural parcel in this county will be developed to its maximum. That's the information that's being tried to convey there.
And I think, the other question was just a follow-up to Mr. Caldwell. He asked another question about, since this is going forward, because it was part of the board's direction, I assume that's the answer you gave, will there be notifications sent out to all affected property owners? Because the concern being this is kind of flying under the radar, under the ag cluster title, where folks may not be aware that their current zoning allowances are at risk.
Our notification obligations on this type of project is usually limited to newspaper notification. I might look to our management to see if they would be considering doing a mailed notification to property owners on this.
Typically what we do with an ordinance amendment of countywide application is we exercise the government code section. This requires board authorization, which we typically get on consent agenda, to use the provisions in the government code for display ads, and so we would do a quarter page display ad in newspapers in a newspaper of general circulation in the county. This is typically the Tribune that we use. We're not required to send notices to each individual affected property owner if we exercise those provisions of the government code.
Can we be assured that newspaper notification?
Absolutely. That's our normal practice.
But will it highlight the specific issue about the two primary residences? I think
yes,
that's the real controversy that's going
yes,
here.
It will.
because that's the key component of the amendments.
And again, I'm not so sure how well it's going to fly under the radar, because the guy delivering my pizza, as I said before, was telling me this is outrageous. So, you know, I think people are already getting wind of it. So, thank you.
Commissioner White, I want to add one point to that, that question as well. We did specifically title the project the Agricultural Cluster Subdivision and Density Program, and the Density Program part of that title is to reflect the change of the allowable density on the existing ag parcels.
Well, I understand that, but it also could be, you know, could be interpreted that it means the density allowed in the ag cluster portion of this.
Sure,
so
sure.
That's where I think a little bit of the confusion lies.
You can rest assured, Commissioner White, that I will look at the notice.
Thank you.
And I'll make
that.
Sure that it's real clear to the average reader.
Because I think we're going to...
Not every single nuance is going to be in there, but that one will be.
Thank you, because I think it'll fill the room here. You know, in my mind, there's a... You know, well, I know we're not supposed to... I don't want to get in trouble.
Okay, let's not. Scoping... A reminder again, 20th time scoping session, so let's hold off on any sort of commentary beyond questions that would prejudge this issue. Commissioner Melko, question.
A question relating to what we're talking about, this second residence on a legal parcel, does that just affect the cluster development, that, or does it affect all parcels in the county?
That would affect all parcels designated agriculture in the inland portion of the county. Presently, within the coastal zone, the limitation is one primary residence.
Oh boy, you are going to fill this place.
The existing ag cluster ordinance allows, and why that would be a concern.
You know, honestly, I'm not certain what the rationale was for that. I don't know if Mr. Hogue was involved with the...
Would you mind repeating the question?
Well, in our staff report on page 3-4, Mr. Conger pointed out in his presentation that in the coastal zone, proposed ag clusters would be limited to the existing underlying lots that are there. And I didn't know, since we're trying to understand this ag cluster on the inland area also, if that's an important... If there's some important reasoning for that, I'd like to know what it might be.
No, I don't have a real solid answer for that. What crosses my mind is that that's what the Coastal Commission...
Yeah, I just didn't know where they found
it. But I'm not really sure if that's accurate.
But,
oh, I'm sorry. I should probably say that again on the mic. I don't have a solid answer. I suspect it may be because that's what the Coastal Commission is expecting, but I'm not sure that's accurate.
Okay, but you don't know what benefit that would be, that the Coastal Commission may have saw a benefit with that? Or?
I think the Coastal Commission would rather not see new parcels created in the agriculture category through the cluster method. So by using underlying existing parcels, that doesn't mean net new parcels.
Okay, thank you.
And I think it may have something to do with a large development in the northern part of the coastal zone.
We'd like to explore that further, Madam Chair. Ms. Kinnicky may have the answer.
Linda Kinnicky, County Ag Department. Towards the end there, Warren got it spot on. The Coastal Commission is not interested in creating new parcels for this, and so that was the purpose for having it be existing underlying parcels. So, and there is, I guess, the recommendations of the Coastal Commission went before the Coastal Commission sometime in the past, I believe 6 months, and I think we could probably provide a link to that report so you could get a comprehensive understanding of what the Coastal Commission was recommending towards the cluster.
Thank you.
Other questions, Commissioner White?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Okay. Other side, any more questions for staff? Seeing none, we'll open it up to public comment then. Have a few speaker slips in. If you haven't put yours in yet, please do get it to us. So we'll start with Eric Greening, and on deck, Dorothy Jennings.
Thank you. 3 minutes. I think we get 3 minutes.
We are up to 3 minutes now.
Yeah. I am Eric Greening, and I know told you so's aren't always welcome, but I think this was important. Life on planet Earth was right all along. The entire ag and open space element in 1998 was approved on a negative declaration, including the original version of these cluster policies, which obviously is more impactful than what now is being seen as having more than 40 Class 1 impacts in a reduced scope. We were right all along, and I just have to say that because sometimes people just seem to be making trouble for the sake of making trouble. Yes, we did sue the county. We spent thousands of dollars. We created a record that fit in a box like this because they made us transcribe hours and hours and hours of hearings, but we did it because we knew the ag cluster policies needed an EIR. And now, to actually even do anything with them besides get rid of them, it's clear that, yes, all along they've needed an EIR. We should have had that information long ago. That said, in the analysis of alternatives, I think the Coastal Commission is on to something. I know some of you are interested in the history behind how things came to be. The original justification for having an ag cluster ordinance, and it goes way back to the Designing Your Future conference 20 years ago, is there are a lot of antiquated parcels out there that if they just developed one by one would cover the ag land with ranchettes. We need to come up with a better design for those existing parcels by clustering. That was the rationale. It was not to create new parcels. It was not to do this whole base density rigmarole from which you would create speculative parcels that had never existed before and then cluster them. The original defined idea behind it was to find a way to take care of existing parcels, and you make a bigger task when you create new. Therefore, speaking to the scoping, one of the alternatives, we need a no-project alternative, which is don't change the ordinance. We need a no-clusters alternative, which is prohibit them entirely. And then in between, in addition to the proposed project, we need a
draft conservation easement. Two, the EIR should include the total number of acres affected and the maximum residential build-out using this particular proposed ordinance versus not using any ordinance. Three, the EIR should address possible conflicts with the urban sphere of influences established by LAFCO, LAFCO being the Local Agency Formation Commission. And the issue there would be whether this agency is in conflict with the proposed ordinance. And four, the EIR should examine LAFCO's agriculture goals, policies, guidelines adopted in August of 2007. And they do have some policies and procedures for the situation where prime agriculture is annexed and must be mitigated on a one-to-one basis.
Thank you, Ms. Jennings. Ms. Harvey, and after that, Leeson Bonnier.
Hi, thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Susan Harvey. At this point, I really only have one suggestion. I would like you to look at an alternative or some method of looking at what cluster permutations would look like. The 2.5 acres for each lot doesn't say cluster to me. And I know there are problems when you have small water districts. This can raise a lot of, you know, issues with the administration of those and, you know, how they're set up, and environmental health, I think, could probably fill your ear with problems that have come up with how those have been set up. But if you've got 20 of these at 2.5 acres, that's 50 acres, which I think is excessive compared to, like, I mean, I guess when you're in the country, people want a half acre or something. But I would like to see the alternative look at what that means, 2.5. Is it going to be, because it seems to me on 2.5, you've got a lot more roads you're even putting in. If you're going to have those, what, are you going to have them spread out for a couple of, you know, it's kind of not as defined as I'd like to see, and I'd like to see some looking into what that's going to mean. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Harvey. Ms. Bonnier, and followed by Paul Lee.
Good afternoon. My name is Lisa Bonnier, and I'm a farmer. I am very pleased to see that we have came this far with the ag clusters policy and that we're moving on with an EIR. I think we all knew that there were environmental and agriculture impacts to the ag cluster policy. Actually, I didn't realize quite how many there were until I started to look at this summary page, and I saw that there were 15 boxes here that you can fill in for environmental factors potentially affected, and ag clusters filled in 13 out of those 15, and they're all under potential significant impact, which means to me that they're unavoidable or under class one. So I think that the time has really came. What started out as a great idea, and I still think that there's potential for ag clusters to be a great idea, is a policy that kind of mushroomed into abuse. And I don't think 20 years ago that anybody had the insight or the foresight to see how this county was going to grow and how the rural areas were going to grow and the size and the impact that ag clusters have had upon the agriculture. What I want to say is, though, that the staff has done an excellent job in complying the concerns surrounding the cluster projects and that you have listened very well to the public speakers. I would like to also thank staff for considering the study regarding the density bonuses. Bonuses were added on 20 years ago as a caveat to make ag clusters move ahead. This concept that we should cluster the houses and preserve the rest of the ag land was a great concept, and I think that they really wanted to sell that to the farmers and ranchers, and that's why the bonuses was added on as a caveat. I think now that we understand that those bonuses are very excessive and that living out in the rural area has always been appealing and the desire for most people to do, so that we're taking a look at the densities now is very timely. So my only comments I have in brief to what we can add on to the alternative projects that was mentioned is that what I do not see in the staff report, but the concept well worth looking at would be the concept of a cap on how many houses can be built. And I'm talking a little bit in the spirits of Ann McMahon on this, because she was really pushing this issue as well. I think it is very important that we're looking at the cap, because if we are looking at just building out what existing parcels are, fundings for farmers without losing their land. And the question is today, that does 100 plus homes, is that enough to supply fundings for family farmers to stay on the land to farm? Or is it actually a number that would have less impact on the environment and the agriculture operation itself that will be suitable? The other thing with the cap is that if we're going by the new protocol, which suggests that we're just going to look at the parcels of the land, we do not want to unleash the antiquated subdivisions that are laying underneath that. And the one way to manage that will be to have yes, you can have up to so many houses. Even if you qualify for more, this is where the cap is.
But the cap would be an arbitrary number set, or what would that be pegged to?
Well, this is what we need to look at, and we have to look at miles per travel, how many houses, how much development do we expect out there, and how much where does these houses, how does that affect agriculture? And go back to the original intention that these developments were really there to help the farmers to stay in their business. If we start to put so many houses on our farms that the farmer itself doesn't want to live there anymore, this is just becoming a backdoor way to develop agriculture, but not really aiding the farmer to stay on the land.
Okay. I'm just hearing the cap as a suggestion for a potential kind of option to weigh in the EIR. And I'm still not understanding the distinction. Does staff understand it? So you can use this as a potential.
We have discussed the option as.
Thank you, Ms. Monier.
We have discussed the option of a cap, and essentially that would be an up to a maximum of number. So
maybe Mr. Singlewald, maybe you can put that on the list for after public comment, and we can go through that and make sure that all the commissioners understand it. If you will, I'll just not try to break up public comment too much. I just wanted to make sure I'm not missing an important concept or potential alternative. Thank you. Next up, we've got Paul Lee, and after that, Sophie Rollins, And if there's anyone else who'd like to speak in public comment, please do get a card up, speaker slip, and so we can hear you after that.
Ms. Madam Chair, I wanted to formally introduce the commission to Mr. Paul Lee. Paul was just promoted to his position at CAL FIRE, and he's going to act as the liaison between CAL FIRE and the Planning Department, and all of us collectively will be seeing a lot more of Paul in the near future. So we should all say hi and welcome.
Thank you for the introduction. As Mr. Knoll said, I am Paul Lee. I'm your CAL FIRE County Fire Marshal. I'd like to address two areas real briefly. The first one would be the wildland interface area. The second one's going to be the public expectation of emergency response. The wildland-urban interface is where the vegetation, the wildland, comes down and meets the structures, homes, commercial, etc. When we do get a fire in that wildland area, it has to be suppressed and structures have to be protected. It's a known fact that it is easier for the fire departments to protect structures that are closer together. I'll illustrate that with an example. If we have 10 structures closely together, I can place an engine ratio of 2-1. Two homes to every one engine to protect that as that fire front moves through. If we spread those same 10 houses out on 300, 400, 500 acres, now we're looking at a ratio of 1-1. That means I need more equipment to protect the same amount of structures. That also means I need more equipment now to suppress the fire. Backing up and looking at that at a global perspective, 10 engines with closer home proximities, I can fight fire and protect structures with 10 engines. Spread them out, I need 10 engines just to protect the structures and 5 more engines to fight the fire. We talked a little bit about the open space. As we get those homes closer together, make open space areas more away from the structures, keep structures in one continuous area, open space in one area, we can protect those structures easier. Public expectation and emergency response. When the public picks up the phone and dials 911, they expect immediate service. This is very easy to do in a city setting. You look at Pismo, pick up the phone, dial 911, they're there relatively quickly. As we get into maybe a suburban rural area where we're putting structures closer together, just because the structures are closer together in that area, they may be very far away from a fire station. That expectation may not be met of immediate service when they pick up the phone. With that kind of two ways to look at it, an education process of letting those people know there's not a close fire station to you, or the other one is possibly building a closer station to them to allow that public's expectation to be filled. As always, thank you for the opportunity.
Mr. Lee, we're glad to have you here. I know
appreciate
it speaks to all of us. Glad to have you here and look forward to working with you in the future. I did have one question.
Please.
When you say close together, you can use a 2-1 truck-to-house ratio.
Uh-huh.
What's your version of close together?
Say that the county and staff should seriously consider removing that portion from the project description of this EIR and instead tailor the EIR specifically to the ag cluster ordinance. To the extent that removal of the secondary residence from the project description for this project is not possible, then the EIR needs to study the economic and the ancillary environmental impacts of that change to the existing zoning, specifically whether that would contribute to a decline in ag production and, for lack of a better word, rural blight. So thank you. Those are my comments.
Thank you, Ms. Rollins. Mr. Wynn.
Good afternoon, Chairman Wyatt and Commissioners. My name is Mike Wynn, and again, I'm raising issues that come within the purview of the RAC, although the RAC has not looked at this yet. I'm only speaking preemptively, not as been commissioned. A couple things fairly quickly. First, it is not obvious why revision of a section in Title 22-.30 would be buried in with everything else here that's basically in 22.22. And that's where you're saying how many homes can be on agricultural land. Either that needs to be titled more clearly so you know you're actually looking at two essentially unrelated things, but you're going to do it as one time, and then make sure the EIR looks at both of those carefully, or you separate them in some way that's useful. And I don't know how to do that, but I'm sure your staff does. Secondly, it isn't clear to me whether this is an EIR that's designed to be de novo. You're looking at the whole program, no presuppositions,
whether you're doing environmental impact study of the update of an existing ordinance. As Mr. Greening said earlier, and I don't know personally, this never had an EIR, so maybe you are doing that. Maybe this is for everything. But if not, you would have different conclusions. It'd be hard for me to see why many of these changes would have any impact at all, since they actually are less than what we have in the existing ordinance. We're reducing the number of homes, we're reducing water demand, we're reducing a whole range of things. So it would be useful to know that. Next, if you are looking at everything, then the pipeline projects that already are out under the existing ordinance should be folded into the EIR because they have not had that same level of review, although your attorneys may tell you that I'm not an attorney, and he'd be exactly right if he said that. Next, you do talk about that it should be within 2 miles of urban areas. If your idea is to reduce vehicles' miles traveled, then it should be distance by road. If you're just throwing out a line for theoretical purposes, then air distance works fine. I would be useful for you to know. And if you're going to do an EIR, you need to know that. How do you analyze this if you're not talking about travel? Fifth, on page 3-26 of the staff report, you talk about changing the quantity or movement of available surface or groundwater, suggests that would be insignificant. If this is a complete look, this absolutely is highly significant. There can be no question about that. Because as your ag policies say, a history of ag pumping does not confer a residential entitlement. So this is all new pumping for new purposes. Specifically in our area, the ag that has gone on, the ag cluster that's proposed at Letitia proposed 100 homes, and it may be a lot less, but Los Barros Creek has dried up just through the ag alone, and now we have seawater coming in where it used to be recharged. These are significant impacts, and they would need to be included in the scoping of the CIR. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wynn. Anyone else wishing to speak on this item who hasn't gotten a speaker slip in? Okay, seeing no one, will close public comment and bring it back to the commissioners. Well, first of all, we'll bring it back to staff to answer questions that have been raised by the public. You're saying we'll end our question about the new cap numbers, cap idea.
Right. So continuing about the cap, we did discuss that option, and we actually hit the nail on the head when you asked, how would we come up with this number? Would it be an arbitrary number? And that was the biggest problem we came up against, is how do you derive that number for what the cap should be. I'll also address a question that Mr. Wynn just had about, is this EIR, is it de novo, looking at the impacts of the ordinance amendment, or just the difference between the existing ordinance and the amendments? And for an EIR or an ordinance amendment, the baseline, what you evaluate, is what's on the ground today. It's not what's allowed under the existing ordinance.
Speak to that a bit, why you've chosen to go that route.
I believe there's a couple reasons behind that, and one of them is that we generally want to discourage starting new private water companies outside of urban areas. And in fact, in the coastal zone, I don't believe that's allowed at all. So that's the primary reason there, and we also wanted to make sure that all of the residential parcels would be self-sustaining. They wouldn't need to rely on infrastructure being located on the agricultural parcel. And we do have some examples of agricultural cluster subdivisions that exist today that have their water facilities on the agricultural parcel, and some that even have septic systems located on the agricultural parcel. The whole point to this was to make sure that all of the parcels would be self-sustaining. And right now, our minimum parcel size to have well and septic system is 2.5 acres.
Okay, so that gets really then to Harvey's question about the choice of 2.5 acres lot size, because that's the minimum for those two. Okay, thanks. Those were the couple of questions that I had still from the public. So back to other commissioners. More questions?
Well, first, just to follow up on the one you just asked, are there other zoning areas that would allow 1 acre for septic and
Right now, the minimum parcel size, if you're creating a new subdivision, is 2.5 acres if you're doing well in septic system. If you've got community water in septic system, you can go down to 1 acre in residential suburban, for example.
So to meet the fire marshal's concerns, 2.5 is the closest we could get these all together under a...
The only way to go smaller would be to have a community water system involved.
And then would 1 acre be the minimum for the septic?
Then it would be. Then you need 1 acre. Although I know the regional board is looking at some revisions to the Central Coast Basin Plan, which may suggest that you'd need 2 acres to do septic systems on some sites. So
it could vary on that.
Yeah.
On different soils and so forth. Then Ms. Rollins asked the question about how intensive the EIR would study the economic impacts to remove that secondary, primary, and other impacts that. You know, I think she mentioned blight and some others.
Environmental impact reports generally don't analyze economic impacts. The only situations where they would analyze economic impacts is if there's a direct physical effect on the environment. And I believe we have some references in the agricultural resource section to these changes possibly resulting in lesser agricultural production, as it would no longer be fiscally, someone may not be able to sustain a farm on the site without having that second residence, for example. So we would be considering physical effects on the environment as a result of these measures.
Well, the resulting riots, I suppose, could have an effect on the environment and the vehicle miles traveled to fill this room. So I don't know if that would be studied or not, but boy, I wish there was a way to pull this out of here.
Commissioner White, to clarify a little bit, so we're supposed to be looking at physical effects on the environment, and economic effects aren't really considered such, but if those economic effects result in physical effects, like blight, as the speaker brought up, then they're fair game for the analysis.
Thank you.
And so how is that determined?
Well, that's determined through the analysis. When we start to quantify the impacts of things, we'll take a look at that.
So if I'm understanding what you're saying, that economic, a need to go further into economics will emerge from the analysis of the environmental, other than economic.
And if it's determined that those economic effects are such that
they result in
physical effects, then we need to address those in the EIR in order for it to be defensible.
Thank you.
To follow up on that, I've got a theoretical question for Mr. Dahl. Okay, I think I'm following you here, but let's say that, because this is my concern that I've tried to express throughout a lot of hearings of last year, is if some folks consider this an overreach, if it could undermine the overall effort of what we're trying to accomplish here with strategic growth and other limiting vehicle miles traveled, what about the effect that tuning out and turning off of the public could have on the overall goals that we're trying to achieve here?
If that effect, again, was like an economic effect, that actually resulted in some physical effect on the environment, like the best example, and everybody always uses it, is this example of blight, where businesses go belly up, homeowners go broke, and blight is on the landscape. That then becomes fodder for your EIR. Otherwise, those types of issues where they are not physical effects really don't have a place in the environmental impact report. Does that make sense?
I think so.
Economics would be an incidental aspect of this.
Madam Chair, I can say something about it. I'm Tim McNulty again with the County Council's office. I think the representations that staff has made regarding when CEQA requires you to perform an economic analysis are correct. Mr. Nall's comments and Mr. Singwald's comments and Mr. Conger's comments, I think we're all correct. It doesn't mean that you cannot voluntarily conduct an economic analysis either as part of the environmental document or as part of the staff work. So there's nothing that would prevent you from finding the money to hire someone to perform an economic analysis. I think the question they were trying to answer is whether or not it's legally required in order to have a, defensible environmental impact report, and I think they were correct in that. Until you get to the point where there's some physical effect associated with the economic effect, there really isn't an obligation to evaluate it in an EIR.
And in fact, we have had EIRs in the distant past where economics was included in the scope of work as an issue area that we looked at, even though there was the potential that it wouldn't result in physical effects. But it, at the time, in both cases, it was the Board of Supervisors that determined that that should be part of the scope. And you're correct, Commissioner O'Grady. I was on the team that helped to write the Ag and Open Space element, and that was the beginning purpose of the Ag Cluster Ordinance, was exactly that, to help farmers out that were having a tough time making a living on the piece of land that they were farming.
Well, given that, it sounds like there is the opportunity to include that, and that this is a scoping session where we're talking about what the scope ought to be. It seems like there are at least several of us who feel like that economic kind of analysis should be part of the scope, so I know staff is writing and hearing that.
Next question, does the scoping session go before the board for that issue? And also, we've heard several people here today. We had Santa Margarita Advisory Council, and we had Mr. Caldwell asked for this to be separated at the very least or pulled from the CIR. Is this going to the board where they could take another look at that request, or does it have to go through the whole process before it comes back to the board?
The board wouldn't see the EIR until they're considering the final ordinance amendments.
So they don't see a scoping session?
No. Like we're holding the one and only scoping meeting that we're going to hold on this. The board, like Erlen said, will be privy to the environmental impact report. And obviously, your decision will be a recommendation to the board, and then they'll make the final decision on the ordinance amendments.
If I heard staff correctly, though, this we are doing this way. Both parts of this are included because of specific board authorization to do it this way. So it's not something that's been put in on the
menu. Actually, it was specific board direction.
Right. So this isn't something that's come along the way. They're not cognizant of already.
That's correct. And based on feedback we've received, we would be doing an alternative that would not include doing the density modification so that once it got through the process, the board could adopt it either way under that environmental impact report.
So as I'm hearing, there are lots of options on the table by the time it gets to them.
Yeah, and the reason
I'm
asking...
Are you comfortable with that?
Yeah, I am. I mean, that we don't have a choice. That's the process. But the reason that I'm concerned about that is I'm concerned this could go a long way to undermine the trust in government here, and that's a real impact and a real concern. It may not be a direct environmental impact, but it's a real impact. And I happened to watch that board hearing where that direction was given, and there was not a lot of discussion amongst the board, from my recollection, about this specific issue. So I, you know, with all due respect to the board, I'm not sure, you know, how much they really thought this through. So I hate to say something like that.
I'll have a chance to think it through, really.
Yeah, and they're going to hear loud.
It's a good analysis of it, too. To me, it seems like if you're talking about ag clusters on agricultural land and you're needing to deal with density issues, you kind of have to deal with this as an issue. And have it be able to be separated out is the option. You want to have it as part of the discussion. You don't want to have it be an automatic thing. And that sounds exactly what the scope of the project is contemplating.
Well, and staff, we're making every effort to make sure that the EIR addresses a wide range of things, because we don't want to bring this EIR back to your commission and then to the board and have it constrain you in your options that you have when you consider these amendments. And so we're doing our best to get our arms around that.
Yeah, I recognize, I can see that, and I appreciate that. So.
Okay, other questions or concerns or alternatives to?
I have an area that I'd like to bring up, and that's alternative projects. Do you have a list of what things might be looked at, or is it wide open?
We don't have a list prepared at this time. We're accepting comments on various alternatives that we would consider.
Okay, what I'm wondering about, how about agriculture conservation easements? I see a lot of benefits there. You're not creating more housing. You're easier on the environment. The only problem is who's going to pay for it. But would that be a possibility, looking at those as compared to the clusters?
to clarify, doing agricultural cluster or agricultural conservation easements on standard subdivisions? Was that the question?
On agriculture ground.
So versus subdivision.
Versus alternative to clustering.
Do a program where we would do agricultural conservation
easements.
Easements.
You're saving on water.
Ag land.
You're not putting in housing. You're saving on water. You're easier on the environment. You're not taking ground out of agriculture to put housing on it.
Isn't that the alternative of no ag cluster?
Yeah, no ag cluster.
That's one of the possible alternatives.
Putting ag conservation easements in the place of clusters.
Yeah, I can see that could be an alternative.
Built in.
I'd sure like to see that looked at, yeah.
Really, alternatives in an EIR, they're meant to address significant impacts of a proposal. So if you have an amendment that has a bunch of significant impacts, what you do in your alternatives analysis is you find alternatives that lessen or avoid those impacts. And so, Commissioner Melskow, that could be that could come out of an alternatives analysis, what you were talking about, as a mitigation.
In the EIR you're talking
about. Right. Yeah, in the alternatives section of the EIR.
Well, I've heard that one alternative might be no clustering.
Right.
Well, okay, fine, but how about looking at agriculture easements? Because, well, I see a lot of benefits. The only downside I see is how is it going to be paid for?
Question. Okay, so I think staff has heard that and could include that as potentially as an alternative. Do you have some other alternative suggestions or questions?
No.
Things to be included on the other side?
Well, it's just the paid for, again, as an economic feasibility. How do you compare it? I mean, that's an integral part of whether that really is a feasible mitigation or not, right? I mean, that's, yeah.
Yeah.
So, Commissioner O'Grady, other questions or alternatives to propose? Commissioner Christensen?
I don't have any further questions. I just have a couple comments. As usual, getting a good project description will be important, having good alternatives, as we've been pointed out. And I probably, when I'm looking at the CR, I'm going to probably be most interested in two things that have probably, I think, they've been mentioned. I just want to emphasize them. One is, yes, the effect on agriculture itself, and the idea that goes back to Ms. Bonnier's comment about the original idea of ag clusters was to actually preserve more agriculture. So I just want to make sure that is kept in mind as we go through the scoping, the EIR analysis. And then the second thing goes to our fire marshal's comments about resources and addressing fires, but I think it also goes to the bigger picture of just the whole public services and utilities analysis part, and, you know, fire, roads, all the things that cost the county money in terms of dealing with development. And so just a real thorough understanding of what those impacts are going to be. And so we can make adjustments depending on the level of impacts. Those are the only two. Those are the big two.
Okay, other commissioners, other questions? Okay, I just had a couple then. One thought is that the EIR needs to look into the effects of nobody applying for the clusters because of lack of incentive. Over projects that we've heard, we've heard that it's messy applying for the cluster, and if the incentive of the extra density isn't there, applicants, several, have said that they just wouldn't apply for the clusters. So I think we need to look at that potential effect. And then along the lines of possible other kind of options to look at, are there maybe some new or other incentives other than the density bonus that we could look at somehow in alternatives so that we might be able to do some of the clustering or incentivize that without the extra density? And I'd also look, following up on the comments of Ms. Harvey at North County Watch, I'd like to make sure we're looking at the 2.5-acre minimum parcel size. As we've heard, several parcels, that could consume a lot of land itself and not, and become not so dense by some of our standards. Those are my comments. Anybody else have anything on the heels of that?
This is taking public comments on possible environmental issues, the purpose of this meeting. So can the public and the commission then assume that all the comments that have been mentioned will be considered in the EIR? Or is there anything else?
Yes, Commissioner O'Grady, you most certainly can.
Thank you.
And don't forget, there's a notice of preparation that went out to various state agencies and county agencies, and so this isn't the extent here of the notification. We've got this project description out on the streets, and we're asking for comments from all of those agencies by a certain date also.
And Commissioner O'Grady, it's a good question, because that was also my understanding, that anything heard here would be taken into consideration. I guess anything we're particularly interested in, we would be likely to highlight or bring up again, because that's of interest to us. But I think the assumption then is that all comments will
and
be considered.
And staff has certainly seen some highlighting here today.
Well, you've got to do something here.
That, along the same lines, could I ask the staff, does that mean that the comments that have been made here today will be formally responded to in the document?
What we do, Tim, is we will have all of the comments, written comments to the notice of preparation in the EIR. And then what I heard the commission saying is that all of the comments that were talked about today would be considered by staff. Where we can't guarantee that all of the comments are actually going to be analyzed in the environmental impact report. Is that?
That's my understanding.
Is that
other
reasonable?
Commissioners nodding to that. I think that that's important, and to reiterate the point that if you have specific concerns that you brought up here today and you want them analyzed in the IR in a written form, to make sure that happens, be sure to get your comments in a written form. And again, maybe staff could put up at this point the contact information emails so that public has another opportunity to take note of those and get comments in by the deadline of the 19th.
And I want everybody also to understand the process here. Once we produce a draft environmental impact report, there will be a 45-day review and comment period, which will give everyone another chance to submit written comments on the analysis that has occurred so far. Those comments actually are responded to in writing in the final EIR. So you can see there are multiple places for input here.
I did not have that understanding when I read the first paragraph of the staff report where it talked about taking public comments on possible environmental issues that should be considered during the environmental review process. I understood environmental review process to be the EIR preparation.
It is. It is that, Commissioner O'Grady.
Okay, but then I heard you say something about the comments that were mentioned today might just be considered by staff, but perhaps not included in not be addressed in the EIR.
Well, and that's what that paragraph says, is should be considered, will be considered.
It's just the distinction, I think, Commissioner O'Grady, between a written response where it's included versus consideration that may not be specifically called out. Is my understanding correct?
Yeah, I think to say it more simply is that when we hold a scoping meeting, we hear lots of comments, and staff uses their professional judgment as to whether or not those comments address issues that rise to the level of being a significant impact that deserves analysis in the environmental impact report. Now, everything that I've heard here today, except for economic impacts, was really addressed in the initial study. And everything that you saw in the initial study, particularly those issue areas that were quantified as being potentially significant, will be addressed in the environmental impact report. I don't think I've heard anything here today, and Michael and Erlen, correct me if I'm wrong, that we haven't already considered when the initial study was prepared. Is that?
I think we've gotten a few additional ideas on alternatives analysis.
On alternatives, yeah. we've heard some new things, and the notion that we cannot separate the physical effects from the economic impacts here. I think that was Commissioner O'Grady's idea.
Yes.
That's something that's a little bit new for us, but we'll take that back and take a good hard look at it.
Okay. Well, this helps me understand the distinctions that I did not understand when I read that first paragraph. So, thank you.
Any other comments from commissioners on this item? Questions? Staff comments? So with that, thank you to staff for the work on this. We'll look forward to this moving along. Way overdue. And thanks for the hard work on it. And with that, any other items before we close the meeting? So do I hear a motion to take the items we've received?
So moved.
Set the record? Okay, and seconded. With that, we will close the... Oh, all in favor?
Aye.
With that, we'll close the meeting.